appreciate you showing up as a, and helping us with this this meeting tonight as we make a few decisions to help with state stuff. We'd like to excuse some of our members. We've got three new members we want to welcome. Missy Wardell. Missy, this is her first night. We appreciate her joining the rack. And then we've got Joe Arnold, who's slipping in here right now. This is his first time. We appreciate him joining us here on the rack. And then we've also got Daniel Davis. And Daniel, we need to excuse him tonight. He, I think, had surgery, and I don't think he's walking. So we need to excuse him tonight.
Oh, he's going to make it here. Come
on. But right now, let's start down. And Tim, let's start with you and kind of introduce yourself and who you represent. We'll just kind of work our way down.
Tim McNashville, representing the Indian Tribe.
Rep. Prevedell, I'm an at-large member.
Joe Arnold, at-large member.
Randy Dirth, for the Sportsman.
I'm Miles Havard. I'm the Habitat Program Manager for DWR, filling in for Boyd Laszlo.
Hi, I'm Dan Abeda. I'm representing the Forest Service.
I'm David Gordon, representing BLM.
Melissa Wardle, or Missy Wardle. I represent the non-consumptives.
And I'm Andrea Merrill, and I also represent non-consumptives.
Thank you. We want to welcome Kirk Woodward. He's on the Wildlife Board. Appreciate him being in and joining us here tonight. And Byron Bateman, he's on the Wildlife Board. Appreciate that. Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate both you guys being here tonight. Hurry back. Okay. So first off, we'd like to again welcome everybody. We need to approve the agenda and the minutes of our last meeting. Is there any changes to our agenda tonight? And any modifications to the meeting minutes of last meeting? If not, then we'll entertain a motion to approve those.
I motion that we approve the minutes and the agenda as proposed.
Any second?
I'll second that.
Dan's got the second. All in favor? Very good. Thank you. Also tonight, we've got these comment cards. If you'd like to approach the rack and issue comments or talk to us about comments, provide feedback on stuff, please fill out one of these comment cards and bring it right up here. Set them. We'll have a pile started right here. But please fill out one of these comment cards and bring them up, and we'll so we know who you are when it's time to do that. And you have to excuse me tonight. This is my first rodeo, so I'll make a lot of mistakes, but please forgive that too. The way we'll do this, we'll have the division provide their presentation to us, and then we'll have questions by the rack to them, and then questions by the public, and then we'll have some comments by the rack, comments by the public, and then we'll do a discussion amongst the group here. And then I'll call for a vote when everybody's kind of had their provided their input. So that's kind of the way we'll our minutes, unless there's any. I think that's the way we do it. So thanks. I get the old nod from Gail. So all right, that's the way we do it. So first off, so right now we'll turn the time to Miles if he's got anything for the Wildlife Board meeting update. Is there anything that Boyd gave you from that?
Not the Wildlife Board, no.
Okay. So we'll skip that. And anything on the regional update?
Yeah, on the regional update, mentioned a few things. Aquatic section has been working on this Red Fleet project. You'll be hearing more about that tonight with the management plan for treating that. They've also been moving cutthroat trout from the North Fork Sheep Creek over into the Middle Fork. The Middle Fork was rodent treated the last couple of years to remove non-natives. So they moved about 800 fish over from the North Fork. So they're going to continue to do those kind of efforts until they can get to the desired densities of fish in there that they're desiring. So in our outreach section, they're busy starting to prepare our youth pheasant hunts and youth waterfowl hunts for this fall. So they're starting to make those preparations to kick off those events. In our wildlife section, they've been busy out classifying pronghorn antelope this year. Recently just finished up that effort. Things are looking good. We have a good number of fawns showing up in the surveys this year. However, Bighorn Sheep just finished that survey just yesterday, and lamb numbers are looking a little bit down on Bighorn Sheep. So good and bad, I guess. The other thing with our deer populations, they're noticing quite a few bucks on some range this year. Good number of deer on many of our units. And right away, within the next couple of weeks, of course, we have archery hunt starting up. So people are preparing for that, especially in our law enforcement section. And one thing I'll mention in habitat section, we've been busy this year, this summer, working on wildlife guzzler projects. This year, we're working on 21 wildlife guzzlers. Those are located throughout the region, some in Dade County, some over on our anthro unit, and several in the Book Cliffs area. So out of those 21 guzzlers, we're looking at being able to store up to 37,800 gallons, just a one-time, you know, capacity on those tanks to provide water for our wildlife. So that's been an exciting effort, and we're just hoping for some more rain as we get those things completed to fill them up. So it's been an exciting project. Might mention that funding for those guzzler projects has been a kind of wide variety of funding sources, including DWR's Habitat Council, the BLM, Sports and Fish and Wildlife, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, the Mule Deer Federation, National Wild Turkey Federation, the Safari Club, Utah Bowman, and Red Leaf Resources that is operating the oil shale development south of the Rome. Both of us have also participated in some of those. And the neat thing also is Boy Scouts have really been helping build a lot of these guzzlers, which gives them a good opportunity for service for those folks as well. So I think that's about all that I have for an update, but it's a busy time of year, and we'll continue to be busy throughout the rest of the fall.
Okay, thank you, Miles. One thing I did forget to do, I neglected to excuse a few of our members tonight. We've got three additional members who are going to be with us tonight, Joe Batty, Mitch Hacking, and Jerry Jorgensen. And so we do need to excuse those three also.
I do have one more item I forgot to mention. There'll be a wildlife board and RAC training on August 26th. That's for the, I think, an orientation. That'll be out at the Shields Conference Room at the Shields Board in Sandy. So for the RAC members that need to attend that, looks like it's starting at 10 a.m. and slaves go until about 4 p.m.
And then the wildlife board meets the following day. So, thank you. With that, let's start. We'll turn to some time to Leslie McFarland with the mammals coordinator and talk about the Cougar Management Plan.
Hi, thanks for having me. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Since we do have new members on here, I'm going to go back a little bit into the history so you understand why we're where we're at today with what we're presenting. So our first Cougar Management Plan was developed and implemented in 1999, and it was a 10-year plan. It was our very first plan, and it actually didn't have a lot of controversy with it through the 10 years that it was in place. When it expired in 2009, some changes were made to that that sought to look at broadening cougar management areas. Evaluations of genetic relatedness of our cougar population shows that all of our cougar populations in our state are interrelated and that they use really broad scale areas. And so the 2009 plan sought to take management out of hunting units and kind of combine them into ecoregions to try and account for the broad use of range that cougars do. The problem is with the ecoregion concept, it created a lot of problems implementing hunting and the social part of the management. Some areas that were easily accessible were over-harvested, and then areas that were not as accessible were under-harvested. Then it led, also with that plan, it had a 3-year recommendation process. So when we made recommendations, whatever we recommended was supposed to stay for 3 years. It created a lot of concern amongst people thinking that, or in some cases, over harvest when it occurred, that we couldn't make changes or address population level concerns for 3 years. And so it created a lot of social issues. On top of that, there was a lot of hard feelings. There were a lot of hard feelings because a lot of the units would go into predator management for deer, and then once it entered predator management, it never came back out. There was no way to evaluate it. At least the public didn't feel like we were evaluating it well enough. So some of the things that we've done in this plan are meant to address these concerns. The Wildlife Board directed the division in 2013 to simplify the plan and allocate permits on a unit-by-unit basis. Unfortunately, it didn't happen in that time frame, and so in 2014, we requested a year to form the Cougar Advisory Group and work on the Cougar Management Plan. The Cougar Advisory Group is the vehicle that we chose to take input over issues and concerns on cougar management. There were over 20 voting members that were involved, and with that large of a group, a lot of times it's hard to come to consensus. I can promise you that sometimes the discussions were very emotional. Everybody's very passionate about their resources. And so the goal of the plan was to try and find middle ground, a place where everybody could be happy and not everybody gets what they want. We had representation from the Mule Deer Committee, the group that worked on the Mule Deer Plan. We had representation from the Farm Bureau, the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep, Guides and Outfitter representation for cougars. We had Houndsmen Association, and then we also invited some houndsmen that were not part of the association. SFW, Wildlife Services, and the Wool Growers, Farm Bureau, and many of these other different groups. We also had two representatives that represented the non-consumptive point of view, and then as well as one Wildlife Board member. We started out each meeting with an educational type discussion so that everybody was starting on the same level as far as cougar biology, predator prey relationships. We tried to keep everybody informed on the latest science. We held 5 meetings from December of 2014 to April of 2015, and over 50 hours of discussion were spent on the management plan. I do want to also, several of the members that were part of this committee are actually here, and I just want to acknowledge them and all of their work and their efforts that they put into their time and their efforts on this committee. It did get heated at times, and it got very frustrating sometimes, but we really appreciate their input and their help putting the plan together. So the plan goal that the group came up with was, the overall goal of the plan is that we will maintain a healthy cougar population within their current distribution while considering human safety, economic concerns, other wildlife species, and maintaining hunting traditions. We defined a healthy cougar population as one that maintains a reasonable proportion of older age animals, breeding females, healthy individuals, is in balance with its natural prey and genetic variability. Our first management objective for cougars is the objective that we established is to maintain cougar populations within their current statewide distribution in a manner that recognizes the large geographic and temporal scales that cougars use. So when we recommend permits for a hunting unit, that's mostly for hunter management. It's where we're managing people more than we are cougars. When our biologists look at areas, they're looking at adjacent units. They're considering all of the harvest that occurs. So when we make recommendations, they're for hunting public. We also wanted to stress the importance of social structure for long-term viability. So one of the targets or performance targets that we put in here is an age objective. We want to make sure that we're not harvesting too many old cougars. We want to make sure that we have breeding age animals that are sustained in populations. And so through our harvest, we want to look at the age structure of what we're harvesting. And again, directing hunter pressure on a management unit or subunit basis, and managing cougar abundance with respect to their ungulate prey. So you'll see a predator management type structure to the plan that wasn't there before. So the way that we manage hunting, cougar hunting in Utah is through three different strategies. The first is limited entry, and basically what this is we recommend a number of permits for a unit. Hunters apply for that, and if you're drawn, then you can hunt the limited entry season. That unit stays open until the season date closes. On a split, what it is, it starts out as limited entry, so we have a number of permits that we recommend. They're drawn, but then we have a transition date that occurs, I believe, around March. And once that transition date appears, any of the unremaining harvested animals in that unit turn into a harvest objective quota. And people with harvest objective permits can come and hunt that unit, or the split permits can go hunt other harvest objective units. And that those units stay open until the quota, or if the limited entry is all filled during the limited entry portion, then it never transitions. If it does transition, then the unit stays open until the quota is met or the season date ends. On a harvest objective season, we recommend a quota. Unlimited number of permits can be sold, so an unlimited number of people can go and hunt these areas. They have to call in every day to make sure that the unit hasn't closed, and once the quota is met, the unit closes, or it stays open if the quota isn't met until the season closes. So we have two different types of strategies for cougar management. We have straight cougar management, and then we have predator management within our plan. Cougar management is a unit or area where we don't have concerns over the prey population, so neither bighorn sheep or deer. They're all doing fine, and so we're managing the unit for cougars. And we'll go over the performance targets for that. Predator management is a unit where the deer herd isn't performing as well, and we've got specific targets, and if it meets those targets, then the unit qualifies for predator management. We also have some targets that we've put in for bighorn sheep. Or if a unit has a transplant that's occurred or will occur, we can do some things to try and help the transplant establish, and then you can back off. So those are the kind of things that qualify a unit for predator management. So the targets for cougar management, we have two. The primary target, the number one thing that we're looking at, is the number of females in our harvest. That's the most important factor, is sex and age in your harvest for your cougar population. And that determines the social structure of your population. So, for example, your females breed, they can breed as early as 16 to 21 months, and males can breed as early as 24 to 36 months. It all depends on when they establish a territory. Until they establish a territory, they won't breed. So if you have a lot of young lions in the population, then you're breeding, they have to go and find a territory and move out. Sub-adult males usually always disperse. females will stay. And your adult males usually have the territories. So we're trying to look at the age harvest as a population status indicator, basically. So then the next thing that we look at will be the age. So we look at females first, and as long as it's less than 40% under cougar management, that's a good thing. Some of our research has shown that when we harvest units consistently on the Monroe specifically, when they had 40 levels of females on the harvest at 42% for a period of 3 years or more, they did see effects on breeding, fecundity, and population level effects. So we want to make sure that on cougar management, we keep our female harvest under 40%. So the secondary target there is 5 years and older. Like I said, they can breed around 2, but most probably won't breed till 3 or 4. So we want to see that we have older age lions in our harvest, but we don't want it to be all composed of older age animals. So we want that goal to be between 15 to 20%. And that's on both of these, it's averaged over 3 years, so that 1 year doesn't throw the whole thing off. We're trying to look at 3-year averages to get a trend. So this is how it would work. If your proportion of females on cougar management unit is less than 40%, then you look at the age structure of your harvest. If more than 20% of your population in your harvest is over 5 years and older, you've got a lot of older age animals in the population, and that means you can increase your permits because you've got some excess animals that you can harvest. If your population is between 15 to 20% of them are 5 years and older, you can maintain because you don't have to increase or decrease unless you've got special circumstances like a livestock depredation issue that you're trying to address or something, you could increase. If your population is less than 15% of those in the harvest are 5 years and older, you need to decrease because you don't have any juvenile recruitment. You're not seeing it in your harvest. Something's going on there. If the proportion on cougar management of your females is greater than 40%, you have to decrease because we're not trying to reduce the population. We're trying to maintain it. So we don't like to see that on a cougar management unit. And then the caveat that we've seen with this, and we've got some units that have very small sample sizes. So like 2 animals were harvested. 1 was male, 1 was female. You have a 50% female. So on those, we request that the biologists really look and evaluate their data. There is one unit in here that is like that. So we have to look at the whole picture. And then after that, you select your harvest strategy, limited entry, split, or harvest objective. So the targets for predator management. So we have some that are established for mule deer. So the first thing that we're going to look at is our mule deer population. And so I worked really closely with our big game program coordinator to come up with the numbers. We looked at a lot of deer data for several years trying to pick the things that most reflect deer populations that are in trouble within our state. And so what we did is looked at deer populations when they are less than 65% of the unit objective in the previous year would qualify for predator management. And then we looked at deer survival as well. So if the deer population is less than 90% of the unit objective and either condition below is met, it could also qualify for predator management. So if your adult deer survival is less than 84% for 2 of the previous 3 years and you have a declining trend, or your adult deer survival is less than 80% the previous year and it has a declining trend, then it would qualify for predator management. So I'll tell you kind of how it worked out this year. All of our deer populations in Utah are doing really well. Going through all of the model data, every single unit in the state has an increasing trend. So that second goal up there, kicks all of our deer units out for predator management. The exception to that are deer populations that are less than 65% of the unit objective. And one of those would be the Buck Cliffs. It's only 56% of the unit objective. So that's why, and there's five of those that qualify for deer. So there's only five units this year that are under predator management for mule deer for cougar. So the goals that, or the targets that we have for bighorn sheep, when a population is less than 90% of the unit objective, or the population has less than 125 animals. And I can tell you that almost every single bighorn sheep unit in the state qualifies for predator management, with the exception of the Zion, Newfoundland Mountains, and Antelope Island. There's another part of the plan that addresses transplants. So if we have a bighorn sheep or a mule deer transplant, we can target those areas with a little higher harvest if it's going to occur in the next year or if it has occurred. Okay, so our performance target, the only thing that we're looking at on predator management, because our goal is to reduce the cougar population and have an effect on reproduction, the only thing that we're looking at is how many females in the harvest there are. And we want to see that above 40% because we are trying to reduce the population. And again, that's within an area averaged over 3 years, so that 1 year of really high harvest or really low harvest doesn't skew the whole thing. So it's an average 3-year trend. So the way that they can set permits based on this performance target is if the proportion of females in the unit is less than 40% under predator management, then they can increase the permits or quota up to 100% of the previous year. If the proportion of females is greater than 40%, then we want them to maintain because they're doing already what we want them to be doing and don't want to increase or affect it any more. And then after that, they select the harvest strategy, limited entry, harvest objective, or split. We do have a couple units in the state that are classified as unlimited take units. These are bighorn sheep management areas only. Bighorn sheep are the primary prey base for cougars. There are not appreciable deer populations to serve as a prey source for cougars. They're all low elevation, snow-free habitats, and little, if any, harvest of cougars occurs in these units. They're open year-round with no limit on harvest. San Rafael, Caparowitz, and Buck Cliffs Rattlesnake are these three areas, and they're the units in dark green up there on the map. And I will say this, there has been a request. So unlimited take is what we call these units. And that method or that tool is only available on these three areas and only for bighorn sheep. We don't allow unlimited take for deer management or anything else in the state. It's only for this purpose. So we had a lot of discussion about bighorn sheep and predator management. And through the committee, we came up with a couple new tools that were put into the plan. And one of those is to allow an individual to possess two cougar permits on the unlimited take units, on those unlimited quota units that we were just talking about. Other tools that already exist is that we use DWR employees to help remove cougars. We can contract with Wildlife Services, or we can contract, this is a new tool, is to contract or authorize someone outside the agency to help with removal of the depredating animal. Like I said, the one thing that I think this plan accomplishes that the previous plans didn't is that we're evaluating our deer population data and our sheep data in conjunction with our cougar recommendations. And it's an annual evaluation. So anytime a deer population drops below 65% or is less than 90% and you've got some adult survival issues, it puts it into predator management. But if it's doing well, it pops it out, and it goes back into cougar management. And I think that's an important part of this plan to point out. There's some other parts of the plan that we really didn't delve into as an advisory committee. We have an outreach and education section, and I think it's important to point out that it is part of the plan. Some of the goals of that are to increase awareness and appreciation for the role of cougars in our ecosystems, to educate and increase awareness of about cougar safety, especially for people that are using cougar habitat during summer months, hiking, biking, all of those type of activities. Providing educational opportunities on the relationship between cougar and prey populations. There are a lot of misunderstandings out there about cougar and prey population dynamics. Educating hunters on how to tell the difference between the age and sex of cougars. To increase selectivity, you know, if we're under cougar management, take males, not females, you know, that type of thing. And then increasing our educational opportunities with our sportsmen's groups and our other interested parties prior to our RAC and our board meetings to try and have everyone understand why we're making the recommendations that we're making. Another part of the plan that we didn't meddle with at all because it's working really well is our chronic livestock depredation section. It primarily occurs on private land, but we also have some that occurs on public land. And we didn't change this at all. If a livestock owner has a history, if they continually graze in an area and every time they go into that area, they know they're going to get depredation from cougars, they can come in and request a permit, and we'll give them a permit to help remove the cougar. Once they do remove the cougar, it becomes the property of the division. There's only a couple areas we have to know that you have a history of depredation there. It's not just a free handout thing. And there are a couple people that take advantage of that. Another part that we beefed up, and I won't go into all the things that we mentioned in there, is just our cougar research. We're looking at doing some things to try and get at population estimates and survival estimates so that we can try and get a better handle on what our cougar populations are in the state. And so we'll be looking at doing that here in the near future. So in summary, we're recommending this be a 10-year plan with an internal review by the division in 5 years. I believe the plan does provide guidance and direction for managing our populations. Recommendations have been greatly simplified. They'll be on an annual basis, and they are unit by unit. I do want to point out again that we did consider prey populations as we made our recommendations. Cougar recommendations that I'll be presenting here in a minute are based or made in accordance with this plan that we're talking about. And again, I do want to thank the members of the Cougar Advisory Group for all of their efforts drafting the plan. It was a lot of time. Thanks.
Okay. Appreciate that, Leslie. I know I just happened to be at the Wildlife Board meeting a year or so ago when they promised 30 or 40 people in that room that was pretty passionate about this, that they would do this, and I appreciate the work that you guys went through to do that for them.
Thank you.
It was very passionate. I think as far as comments, I think all these cards actually have to do with the next topic, which is the quota recommendations and stuff, unless anybody has any for this one. I don't think I have any for this one. All right, thank you. Well, then we'll go to questions by the rack.
I had one question, and I probably just missed this, Leslie, but I was confused as to whether you can make changes based on, like, 1 year of data that says maybe a deer population is declining or a bighorn sheep population is declining versus, say, waiting to see a trend in 3 years. Can you go back?
I'm
really confused about that.
Okay, so what we look at, so we have a couple previous years. So if we have a really bad winter and we drop below 65% of the unit objective, it would qualify for predator management. Or if two of the previous 3 years, it drops to below 84% survival. Or if in the previous year, survival is less than 80%. So if you, so like a deer herd that had survival that was only 75%, it would qualify.
Thank you. I have a question.
Okay, yep.
Where your strategies managing the health of the cougar population, in one of the letters from one of the interest groups, it quoted more of a desirable population of cougars, and it said 1.7 cougars per 25,000 acres, I believe is what it was.
Is this the Humane Society letter?
Do you have a feel for, are your studies kind of evaluating the population of the actual number of the cougars, or is that something you just feel not reasonable?
So that's what I was trying to get at when I was talking about future research. Cougar population numbers are really, really difficult to try and determine. With bobcats, like we'll talk about in a minute, you can go back and you can use a model that takes and kind of builds the population back based on the age structure. The problem with that model and using it on cougars is that you make assumptions about the population that we violate and that we don't know. And so we don't feel comfortable relying completely on that. So in the plan, there's actually two population estimates that were done modeling, looking at habitat. And then this past year, what we did is we also took our age data and we did a population reconstruction. And it's the same thing I kind of did on bear populations. And what you do is you build back the population. And in order to have those ages in the harvest at that time, you figure out what your minimum population of cougars has to be. It's not the most reliable estimate, but it gives us a ballpark. And so we can say that we have to have at least 4,100 cougars in our state. The problem with that is that when you start saying numbers, people hold you to that number. And I can't tell you that that's exactly what we have. And so what we're trying to do is look at research projects in the future that get at survival estimates for populations that we can start to put into those models so that we're not violating assumptions, and then we can get a better handle on our populations. We're working on those types of things, but until then, the only thing we can do is our habitat estimates on cougars and population reconstructions. And that's why we use those population trend indices, the age and the sex and the harvest, so that we monitor what we're doing.
Thank you.
Any other questions by the rec?
I have one. I believe you mentioned in this new plan that you would be exploring other ideas to estimate the population.
Yeah.
Could you kind of say what they are or again?
We're still working it out. We're working with Utah State to develop some ways to get at this. Some of the things we're looking at are doing something similar to like the mule deer survival, where you have collars in an area, you monitor that area, you look at survival and those animals, and you follow them through time. What we're not sure is exactly what type of sample sizes we'd need, and so that's what we're looking at. We're trying to go maybe that direction. So that's one start, but we've got several different others that we're working through.
Any other questions by the rep? Okay, questions by the public? No? Okay, comments by the rec? Comments by the public? I don't think we have any cards. All right, any discussion? How are we feeling about this?
I motion that we accept the plan as presented.
I'll second that.
We have a motion. Brett's got a second. Any other discussion? All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's unanimous.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, Leslie, you're up next on the Cougar Recommendations and Rural Amendments.
Good
So like I mentioned earlier, cougar harvest in Utah has been managed under limited entry. Well, I didn't mention this part earlier, but we started managing cougar populations under limited entry hunting in 1999. Prior to 1969, it was unregulated. There were no licenses, no permits, all of that kind of thing. They weren't really a protected species until 1969. In 1999, we implemented limited entry hunting strategies. And in the mid-90s, you can see there about 96, we had a dramatic increase in the number of permits that we were offering, as well as the harvest. That went up a great deal. And that actually was a west-wide trend. Cougar harvest across the entire West increased during those years. In 1997, our state added additional hunting pressure by switching some of our limited entry units to the harvest objective or quota system. The year that we did that, we sold a record high of 1,496 permits. Since 2000, we've averaged about 327 limited entry permits and an average quota of 254. This past season, we offered 460 permits. 253 of those were limited entry or split, and 207 of those were quota. The total sport harvest for this last year was 330 animals, with a 45% success rate for limited entry or split, and a 68% success rate for harvest objective. Total harvest, including wildlife services, nuisance, and other mortality, was 345, so an additional 15 animals on top of sport harvest. This is compared to 376 in 2014, so it decreased this past year. The important thing, like I said earlier, to track management-wise on cougars are the number of males that you're taking versus females. So if you look at this sport harvest chart, the top line is both male and female combined. The dark brown line are your total males in the harvest that year, and then the rest colored line on the bottom are your total females in the harvest that year. Anytime that your females are equaling or exceeding your male harvest, you're affecting the population. So statewide in 2004, our female harvest exceeded our male harvest. And in 1997, our female harvest was almost equal to our male harvest. You can see since about 2007 that we've kind of changed that trend, and we've got fewer females in the harvest and more males, and that's what we like to see as a split between those two. This is just another graphic representation of females versus males in our harvest. So the light gray color are the number of males by year in our harvest, and then the dark gray are the number of females or the proportion of females in our harvest. The dark spotted line in the middle is our 40% threshold. So you can see that between 97 to about 2005, we were exceeding that 40% threshold on our females. Since about 2005, we've maintained at 40% or been below 40%. This is just a graphic representation. So all of the cougars when they're harvested, it's a mandatory reporting system. So when a hunter harvests a cougar, they have to bring it in. We take a tooth off of the animal, age it, and we record sex and age and location. So you can see we've gone back to 1999 because we've continued to maintain all of the age data on our populations. And you can see that, so the 1999 plan actually had an age objective in it. It had an objective of 6 years or older, and I can't, let's see, I've got the percentage here, where is it? I think it was 15% or greater in the harvest had to be 6 years or older. In the 10 years that plan was in effect, that target range was never reached or obtained. a lot of that has to do with social pressure on cougar hunting. You'd have to restrict permits back quite a bit to get that kind of age structure in your population. So you can see that from 1999 through today, we've been pretty good at maintaining a 10 to 20% of the harvest being 5 years or older in our harvest. In 2005, it dipped down quite a bit, and then this past year, in 2013, 33% of the harvests were 5 years and older, and then in this past year, it went to 23% were greater than 5 years or older. So the committee discussed this at great lengths, and that's actually one of the most emotional discussions was the age objective. So we chose to go with 15 to 20% at 5 years and older because it's something we could currently achieve. So we also monitor livestock depredation and the number of incidents. You can see that since 2001, we've gone down quite a bit with the number of incidents and the number of removed. Since 2001, we've paid $907,337 for livestock confirmed killed by cougars. In 2014, we paid out $148,000, of which $44,000 was for cougar depredation. We had 34 claims and 241 confirmed losses compared to 350 confirmed losses the previous year. So we are seeing a little bit of a declining trend in our livestock complaints. So I'll go to the recommendations part, and I'll just kind of explain my color coding scheme here. So the very far left column, that's the unit name. The second column over is if the unit qualifies for predator management. It's in bright yellow, and it tells you what it's under predator management for. The next column over are the number of permits or quota that were offered last year. The next column over are the percent females for the past 3 years for that unit. The next column over are the percent of five-year-olds, the percent of the, or I can't talk. The percent of the harvest that were 5 years old or older. And then for the past 3 years. And then the next column are the recommended permits or quota for this year. If it's green, it's a recommended increase from the previous year. If it's orange, it's a recommended decrease from the previous year. Then the final column is the strategy. If it's white, it's a recommended change in strategy from the previous year. So I'll just go through the changes from the previous year to this year. Unless you have a specific question, we can go back during your comment or question period. The recommended changes for the northern region, Box Elder Pilot Mountain, they're recommending an increase of 2, and they're recommending a change to harvest objective from split because they can't get the harvest out there that they need, and they're trying to increase take. On the cash unit, they're recommending an increase from 15 to 20. The East Canyon unit, they're recommending an increase from 4 to 6. And the Morgan Southridge unit, that's one that's outside of the target ranges. It's at 44% female, but we've got some specific issues on that unit that are not the same as any other unit in the state. It's 90 to 95% private lands. So the landowners largely control what you can harvest, and some of them require harvested females. And so that information there is a little skewed, and we know that we've got more males in the area. It's just they're not being taken. So it's more of a management thing. It's a small sample size, and we're trying to increase harvest there to address some increased depredation and nuisance problems. The Ogden unit is a decrease in one because it's over 40% female. And then I'm going to ask Dax to come up and give you the recommendations for the Northeast region, and then I'll finish the remaining regions.
Is that because he's bigger and has bigger shoulders, or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, he's my bodyguard tonight.
You might need it. I'm Dax Mangus, Wildlife Program Manager here in Northeastern region. Not a lot of change in our region. I guess I'm going to start at the bottom. So the Wasatch Mountain Current Creek, which is that's our unit that we manage as a limited entry unit for cougars, is doing really well. Percent female is really low, and 5-year-old molar is really high. The folks are killing really big, nice toms on that unit. The deer population is doing well on the unit, and the increase there is just really because we felt like we had the opportunity to give a couple more folks that opportunity to hunt, big mature toms. Our other big change recommendation from last year to this year would be the Book Cliffs unit, and I know that's one that's gotten a lot of attention. We are currently at 56-57% of our deer population objective on the unit, and are trying to reduce the lion population in the Book Cliffs to try to grow more deer to get closer to that the mule deer population objective. Despite some pretty substantial increases, the percent female in the harvest is still low. We're not even close to that 30%, and they're still killing old toms as well. The permit recommendation last year was for, I think it was 30 permits, and that through the racking board process was reduced to 20 permits. And this year, we're recommending the 38 permits. We recognize that some folks are not happy about that, but the intent is to try to reduce the lion population in that area, and that's the reason behind that objective, or behind that recommendation. And unless you have other specific questions about other units, those are really our ones that were recommended and changed to.
And I think right here I better just help Dax by just clarifying something. So just because a unit goes under predator management for deer and we target cougars, it doesn't mean an automatic increase in deer populations. One of the things that it's important to remember is that predators and prey cycle together. Deer and cougars will cycle together, so if you have a crash in your deer population, they've followed this, and we followed it in Utah on our units where we've done research. It takes about 8 years for the lion population to have a subsequent crash after that crash on the deer population. So it's not that they're trying to limit the number of, they are, but what they're trying to do is kind of simulate that decrease in cougar earlier instead of having it follow 8 years later so that the deer can recover sooner. And then once you stop, once the deer get where you want them to do, you can relax on the cougar harvest. So I just want to, I hope I didn't confuse it more, but I think that might help understand what they're trying to do. The central region, most of their changes had to do with strategy change. The central mountains units, they're recommending going from split to limited entry. On the central mountains northwest manti, that unit, the percent female is at 42%, so they need to decrease. It's not under for predator management. Central mountains southwest manti, it's at 42% female, and it is not under for predator management, so they also have to decrease there. The Oker Stansberry, they are recommending an increase of 3. They've got a really low percent female and a really high age proportion of animals that are over 5. So they're doing an increase there. And then the last two changes for that region, the West Desert units, they have a really hard time getting harvest. They've tried different things, limited entry and that type of thing. And so they're trying to increase interest in those units by switching strategy to harvest objective and split. The Southern region, the change on the beaver, they're at 43% female, so they're reducing that unit. The Fillmore Oak Creek, no changes there. The Fillmore Provence is right at 39%, so they recommended a decrease of one. Mount Dutton, this is an amended recommendation since the Northern Region RAC. It is at 60% female, but the past several years and this fall, they will have, they've got a recommended goat transplant there. So they're seeking to maintain that level of harvest until those transplants take hold.
Leslie, what was it before that recommended?
They recommended a decrease of 3, so from 14 to 11. On the Poncegonts, they're recommending an increase of 2, and the Plateau Fish Lake, they're recommending an increase in 2. Southwest Desert, they're recommending an increase of 1. Southeastern region really didn't change anything. They kept everything status quo as they've had it. They feel comfortable where they're at right now with lion harvest, and so they didn't make any changes from previous years in that region. In order to implement one of the tools that was recommended in the plan through the Cougar Advisory Committee, we're recommending a rule change to the Cougar Rule to allow a person to purchase a second Cougar permit and use that only on the unlimited quota units, those unlimited take bighorn sheep units, the ones that are in dark green. In order to have that control permit, they have to have a harvest objective permit or a split permit that transitions and it hasn't been filled after the date. They can purchase a Cougar control permit and use it only on the unlimited take units. It can't be used anywhere else in the state. And those units, again, are the Buttcliffs rattlesnake. The southeastern region's adding a portion of the 9 Mile to that. The Kaparowitz and the San Rafael. Just a summary of our limited entry permits this year from last year. 2015, we recommended 215 limited entry or split permits. This year, we're recommending 246. Last year, the quotas were at 207. We're recommending an increase to 249. So it's a net increase of 32, and a good portion of that goes to the Buttcliffs. The southeastern region, like I just mentioned, had a boundary change request. They want to take the 9 Mile, which is the whole red unit, and split it into a 9 Mile north and a 9 Mile south. The 9 Mile south boundary follows, I believe that's Range Creek right there. So it's that little teeny portion on the bottom, and they're adding that to the Buttcliffs rattlesnake and making that part of the unlimited take quota unit. The Oker Stansberry West Desert Tinnick, we also have a boundary change request. This is just to make the boundaries consistent with mule deer boundaries. This was a boundary change last year that they made for deer. And this is just to keep the unit boundaries consistent. The season dates we're recommending for Cougar. Limited entry would go November 11th through May 31st, 2016. The split units, the limited entry portion would run November 11th through February 26th, 2016. There would be about a week rest, and then it would transition to harvest objective on March 3rd. And run through May 31st. Harvest objective units would be open November 11th through November 6th, 2016. Unlimited quota units, November 11th through November 10th, because they are open year-round. And then our pursuit season that we're recommending would go November 11th through May 31st. So in summary, our recommendations have been made in accordance with the Cougar Management Plan. All females were considered in the harvest. Our age performance target is an extra measure on our population indices. Our recommendations will occur annually and will be on a unit-by-unit basis. and it incorporates prey population performance into our cougar recommendations. And again, because we're doing this annually, it'll allow us to evaluate predator management in conjunction with our prey, with the prey populations on an annual basis. It really doesn't result in a significant increase or decrease in the permit or quota recommendations, with the exception of the one unit. Thank you.
Thank you, Wesley. I guess I got a couple questions I'll kick it off with. Since the booklets went to Harvest Objective of 2 or 3 years ago, has our quotas been met?
Yes.
Each year?
Yes, it's closed twice. Fairly early. The first year it closed February 8th, and this last year it closed January 22nd.
Okay, thank you. And the other one, what is the other RACs, what have they thought about this? Have there been any problems? I mean, they're maybe not quite as passionate about them as we are, but what do they think about even the booklet?
The Northern Region accepted our recommendations as we presented them. The Central Region made a motion to decrease the permit, the quota from 38 to 30, and that failed. The Southern Region took it as recommended. The Southeastern Region recommended an increase only to 25.
In the book cliffs. Okay. Which region was that?
That's the Southeastern Region.
Southeastern Region. Okay, thank you. All right, questions from the RAC?
Got one.
Yeah, Missy?
All right, question on the, you might have addressed this since I'm new to this, but on the book cliff deer, are there other methods going forward to try to address the deer population outside of predator control?
Do you want to address that, Dax?
I would have Miles talk about the habitat projects. The region should address that.
You know, I don't have any numbers, but there's been thousands of acres of habitat improvement work going on in the book cliffs, largely pinyon juniper removal through chainings and bulldog type projects. And then in addition, the last 5 years, we've been pretty aggressive with developing water, largely with guzzler projects, but also some springs and other type of projects that way that we're hoping will increase our deer populations out there.
We've also done collar studies to look more at doe survival out there, and we got the Coyote Bounty Program.
Did they reduce the number of deer permits down there, too?
Yeah, the buck permits. We have maybe cuts on those, too.
Ben, tell us more about the doe mortality in the summertime.
You know, we found with those adult doe collars, and they're not GPS collars, so we can't access them as quickly as we'd hoped, or as we hope we could, but we are finding a fair amount of does dying on the summer range up mm-hmm. high, which is a strong indicator of predator mortality as far as the main cause.
It's actually a pretty even split. I've been working on this study, so about 50% on the winter range, 50% on the summer range, more or less.
Okay.
Brett? Leslie, did I hear you correctly when you said the success rate is higher on the HO than the limited entry?
Yes. Harvest Objective is the success rate is 68%. Limited entry is about 43%.
Wasn't the Harvest Objective intended to bring a lot of hunters in and have a lower percent rate?
You mean 68% of the quota was filled? Or do you mean 68% of the guys that bought a tag killed?
Well, 68% of the quotas are filled.
Oh, I thought it was a success rate. Excuse me.
Well, no, it is the success rate, but it's...
Of an individual hunter,
because it's unlimited numbers of permits, so you can't compare it with permits. It's...
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for asking that.
I did have another.
Missy?
The 9 Mile rattlesnake boundary movement, is that because there are bighorn sheep in the area, or are you doing it to reflect the mule deer? Like,
No. So like I said earlier, unlimited take is not a strategy ever for mule deer. It's because there are primarily bighorn sheep there and little to no mule deer.
Any other?
Yep. Yeah, I had a question. You mentioned that the deer population in the Book Cliffs is at 56% of the population objective right now. How far back does that date? I mean, what's the population trend? I mean, it's been going down for three years, five, eight, what?
Let me do this. So I've got a table here, and this might help. So this is what we look at when we put this together. Justin and I sat down and put these together based on the triggers. So let's go to the Book Cliffs unit specifically. So this is the deer unit for Book Cliffs. The corresponding cougar unit is also Book Cliffs. So the population objective for mule deer on the Book Cliffs is 15,000. In 2011, it was 6,200. 2012, 7,300. 2013, 7,850. 2014, 8,600. So these are the percents of objective back to 2011. So 41, 49%, 52%, and this last year, 57%. So it meets the one trigger because it's below 65% of its objective. Then the second thing that we look at, remember I said if we look at if it's less than 90% of objective for the previous 3 years, it is. So these are the previous 3 years, It's less than 90% of its objective. And then we go and we look at adult doe survival. So it would be kicked out under the adult doe survival thing if it were just less than 90% or whatever, because for 2 or 3 years, it's above 84%. And the last year, it's not less than 80%. The thing that keeps it in predator management is that it's less than 65% of its objective. And then the last thing that we look at, the other thing that, like I said, we took the trend from all of the population models, and right now all of our deer herds are increasing. There isn't one in the state that's decreasing, but because it's less than 65%, it qualifies.
So it's trending upward.
It's trending upward, but it's not reaching its objective. And right. So once it does, or if it did, then you could take it out.
We were on kind of a stable to slightly increasing trend until about 2009, and then we had a pretty precipitous drop. The deer population had a bad winter, had a pretty big drop, and so that I think that 2011 was about the low point. So it was either 10 or 11, I think it's a low point, and then we kind of turned the corner and started to come back.
That population objective was it 15,000? Have we ever been near there in the Book Cliffs?
I'd have to look back. Not in the last decade.
Okay.
We've been around 10,000 and that neighborhood, but I think it's been a while since we've been.
Any other questions from the rack?
Maybe just, is there a pretty direct correlation between quota numbers and deer populations coming up? Is there enough data to look at that?
No.
So if we increase quota, then the deer follows. Is there too long of a lag between the two?
Unfortunately, it's one of those things that correlation doesn't really mean causation, and there are so many other factors that affect mule deer in addition to predator control. So predator control is just one of the things that we can control and that we can do. And the other things that we do, we're doing the coyote bounty program, and like Miles said, we're doing all of the habitat treatments to try and increase it. But it's just one of those metrics that you can control, but can you prove that it really has an effect? It's really difficult without a lot of collared animals and a lot of intensive on the ground monitoring. So it's not really a cut and dry, you can't show it.
Is it true that that there's studies that show that basically one cougar will take one deer each week?
That's another thing that's really difficult to say. I mean, it averages that, but age, If a cougar learns to specialize, that affects its ability. If it's a female, they'll take more because they have kittens to feed. So it's not really it's kind of an average, a general thing, but it's not, I mean, they're opportunistic. So they'll take whatever, if it's an out calf, they'll take an out calf. So it's really hard, I mean, and if they take that out calf, then they don't need to take a deer. So it's really hard to take that and just put it across the board and say, this is how many they kill. They'll eat rabbits, they eat porcupines. And so it's just whatever. Porcupines are actually their favorite food.
Thinking of pulling them out of a dog.
No, they do. A lot of times the houndsmen can vouch for this, they'll get quills in their nose. We've had them where they get porcupine quills into their lungs and lungs collapse, and it's kind of nasty, but
they are fatty.
They love porcupines.
Any other questions by the rec?
Yeah, I just had a question. So again, the change to 38 was to try to speed up the population crash for the mountain lions that usually lags 8 years behind deer. And let's see. So, and you'll evaluate next year to see what actually the effect has been on the deer population.
What they're trying to do is on the book cliffs, they're trying to get, where is that? They want to get percent females from 28% to over 40%. And so the way that they're trying to accomplish that is by increasing permits.
And why did you choose 38?
Why did you choose 38?
That was about the maximum we would be allowed to recommend based on the parameters that are in the plan.
Okay.
So we've made some pretty big increases and mm-hmm. didn't see a big increase in the percent amount. So.
Okay.
And like I said, if you hold, our research on other populations has shown that if you keep it at least 42% for multiple years, you affect reproduction, you affect the population and the social structure, and that's what they're trying to do.
Tim, where the book cliffs are so close to the reservation, you know, we've only got maybe 20, maybe 15 guys that really hunt them. Those lions will travel a long ways to establish new ground. And when you start seeing lions and not having to track them to see them, you know you got a problem. And our sheep population is way down. So there's a lot of them coming out of Desolation Canyon and Florence Creek. I know there was one lion killed that was 238 pounds last year.
Any other questions by the rec? Dan?
Yeah, follow-up question to Tim's comment. Are you seeing a population decline in deer
yes.
on the tribe, on
yes.
the reservation as well?
Yes. Even on elk. Or elk, we only have like 900, and I think there was 989 elk on the reservation last year. And that survey was done in the early part of February. And the deer population is down.
Do you guys have population objectives, things like that?
There's only four, I'm going to guess maybe 450 people that hunt. So, we've got the north unit and the south. And in the Hill Creek unit, we've only got 100 elk tags that we give out, and that's it. In the north unit, there's probably maybe, if that, maybe 125 elk that's killed.
I was just going to say, what Leslie says is true. It's hard to equate, correlation with causation as far as, harvesting more lions, does that directly result in a growing deer population? That's hard to prove. But,
as well as, you know, does a lion necessarily, does the lion kill 50 deer a year? You know, maybe on average across different areas that is the case. You know, we had a cougar management workshop in Cedar City, I think it was last summer or two summers ago. You know, and they did a study on the Colorado side on the Tahlequitz Plateau and showed that in areas with higher bear densities, the cougars actually killed more deer, because after they'd kill a deer and feed on it, then the bears would steal it from them, you know. And, you know, Book Cliffs is an area where we're way below objective. We have a lot of lions, you know, and our harvest data reflects that, where we're harvesting a lot of lions, filling our quotas quick. They're taking mostly males and a lot of older age class animals. We also have a high bear density in the Book Cliffs. We have our radio collar study on our adult does showed much lower survival than what we had hoped for and anticipated. Our survival, especially the first few years we started the study, was in the 70% range, and you hope for it to be 85% or higher. The last couple years, adult doe survival has jumped up a little bit, and it's hard to equate that directly to cougars, but we did find that about half of our adult doe mortality was on the summer range. And typically, you know, a summer range mortality on those mule deer, a lot of times is predators, because there's not a lot of the things that typically will kill them in the summer. There are some other things. It's hard to prove everything. You know, there's EHD, there may be some disease issues, but we have a lot of evidence that has been calculated and taken into consideration in forming the recommendations.
Thank you, Dex. Any other questions by the RAC? Okay, questions from the public? No questions. All right, comments by the RAC? I think Dex made a pretty compelling reason why they've done what they've done. Appreciate his explaining that to us. All right, we got comments by the public. Let's do it in this order. Let's go, is it Dan Cocaine? Let's go you first, then Mike Davis. JC, you wanted on this topic also, right? And Al Kettle. And then Guy Webster. I'm just going to go in that order if we could. Yeah, when you come up to the mic, please introduce yourself, and thank you.
I'm Dan Cocaine. I'm president of Utah Houndsman Association. I actually sat on the board to simplify that plan. How did you like that simple plan? It's a complicated issue. There's no simple answer, and there are some things that we've taken into account on the Book Cliffs as sportsmen, as houndsmen, as the guys that are out there all the time. One thing to consider, you can hunt the Book Cliffs in a two-wheel drive pickup all winter. So the fact that we fill the quota really fast, it's access, it's easy. There's roads everywhere, and because of the oil field, they keep them plowed. And so I'm not so sure that's a great indicator that there are tons of lions. I think the best indicator of what the lion population is doing is the guys that are out there, and that's why we're here. We're representing those. And to a person, everyone that I've spoke to about the Book Cliffs talked about how low we've knocked that lion population, how there are places where they would always find lion tracks, and now, you know, they spend 30 days out there hunting bears and one trap or no trap. So I think we've done some really good things for the deer out there. There are things that we haven't done. The wild horses, if you've been out there, they're thicker than fleas, and they weren't like that. I never used to see a buffalo on the Book Cliffs. So there's a lot of things that are competing with those deer, and we just think that a 90% increase without taking all those other things into consideration is just too much. And we would ask that you would vote for no more than 5 increase. We can take this a step at a time. All the studies have said that God will do this in another year. I mean, we're almost to 8 years in this crash, and so, you know, I think we're just asking that we that we don't take these drastic measures and not a 90% increase. Part of the, in that 3 years, wasn't in this management strategy. And so if you take a limited entry unit and the manage and you take those hunters are in there for trophies, and they'll look at lots and lots of lions and may not take one. A harvest objective puts a lot more pressure on them. It's, for one, it's a race to get it done before it fills, and especially on the book list where you have all that access. You know, the other rack that is a, that the book cliffs affects, that's what they voted for, and that's what we'd ask you to vote for. It's no more than a 5 increase, which is about 25%, and take it a little slower. The deer are increasing. The, all the statistics say that that deer herd's come back. There's been some good things done for it, and you know, we don't want to lay it all on the cougars because, frankly, we none of us know. We just know that we really put it into. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. If we can just figure out how to get those cougars to eat horse flesh, we might be.
There's some in Arizona that do. We ought to go get some of those.
My name is Mike Davis, and I'm representing myself tonight. First of all, I'd like to say I appreciate all the work that you guys do, the work that the division does, and the work that this committee did on this Cougar Management Plan. I believe the Cougar Management Plan has very good ideas. I believe we can make it work. But guys, we're hunters, we're not exterminators. And when you increase it by 90%, you're taking a very great chance that you're going to exterminate that population. It's probably not going to happen that rapidly. But 90% increase is ridiculous. We think that, you know, personally, I believe a 5 cougar increase is plenty. Let's get off of this roller coaster. We've had these cougars and we've been going like this for years. We get a high mortality rate, they drop the number of tags. We get a lot of cougars, they raise the number of tags. Let's take it slow. Let's let this management plan work, and let's take it a little bit slow. Take 5 more than we took last year. If we have to take 5 more next year, then let's do so. But let's not jump up 90% in 1 year. I think that's ludicrous. Again, we're hunters, not exterminators. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. GC?
Just down here for us little guys. Okay, I'm GC Brewer. I'm a lifelong resident of the Book Cliffs. Grew up out there as a kid. I see trends. I go back out there a lot. And what these gentlemen just referred to says that the best information you can get on things out there is by from the people who are out there. I'm out there. I'm not a houndsman. I never killed a bear or a cougar in my life. Probably never will. I'm a deer advocate. I'm the guy that was in here last year at this meeting after the fish and game to increase the pressure on the predators out there to help with this deer herd. Now, before I make any recommendation, first I want to congratulate the Habitat folks for the work that they've done out there. I love it. I appreciate it. Miles, and your guys are doing great. The Guzzlers, wonderful. The tree shreddings, great. I love the Habitat work. We needed it. But I also want to go on record here as completely supporting the division's recommendations for the on the Cougar plan. I support the harvest objective, and I support the number. Last year, my only objection to the plan was that the number wasn't high enough. I see a significant increase in the number of for the coming year. I support that number completely. Thank you.
Thank you, GC. Al?
I'm Al Kettle. From what I've seen of the deer populations throughout the book lists, very rarely do you see your good animals. You see very good, you're starting to see better numbers, but there are a lot of predator issues. I support our biologists and what they recommend. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. And Guy Webster.
Yeah, Guy Webster, give you a little introduction. Started Hounds 1984. Probably only one guy in here that's had him that long sitting right here next to me. Lived in Green River since 1990. Outfitter on the south side of the book list as well as the top of the book list. So I'm not here just about lines. I'm as important as, of course, deer and elk as I am lions, but 38 is absolutely insane. We've taken 68 lions off the book list in the last 3 years. The population is definitely on a severe decrease. Part of this, Leslie, and part of this is, you know, us as houndsmen, we've really been pushing to try to decrease the male proportion, not just the females. That's hunter ethics. I think some of the guys out there, we can be thanking ourselves for targeting them toms, and but, you know, at the same time, we get kicked in the butt because we're not killing the females. Kind of a catch-22. Somebody out there that hunts every year, every weekend, every year, every day off, every year I'm out there. Big portion of your lions out there eating your elk. The elk are seeming to do okay. Your deer population is coming up. It's not what I like to see, but we've got to keep in mind there's horses out there like we've never seen. We've got buffalo out there. We've got a lot of other factors coming into it. I'm sorry to say, but the south side of the book cliffs, what was normally Cunningham's Ranch, used to have great hay fields in there. Deer love that. Them hay fields are non-existent. There's more feed right there on that table than what's in them hay fields. The deer are struggling. That's going to play into your female mortality. Them deer are not doing good. There's not enough feed down there what was once prime, lush feed. We can go on Three Canyon Ranch off the south side of Hay Canyon. Same thing. We can go on. Joe, you talked about, you know, what happens with wood and I like deer. You read the management plan, you start looking into studies. There's been studies. We have done that. Monroe, we did a study. The Meekum brothers went down there, harvested every lion they could. There was not a statistical increase of the deer herd. Your habitat is your number one thing. You go right in. Read your management plan. You guys just voted on it. I mean, right there. You're talking it. That's right out of the studies. It's not the lions. We've got to go back and look. Drop the deer tags. There's not been a significant enough drop of buck tags out there in the last 5 years to write home about. You know, we're sitting here saying kill all the lions. Let's do something besides just kill all the lions. We know it's not going to work. It's proven that it's not going to work. All we're going to do is we're not going to have as many deer as we'd like to have. We have not had 15,000 deer out there since 1990 when I started hunting book cliffs, and I don't know if that's a realistic number. We'd never do. That's something the real deer team needs to evaluate and see, is that even a realistic number for the book cliffs? But we don't need to annihilate and let's have no lions in addition to not having deer numbers and stuff. That's all I have to say. And one other thing, I think you guys have all seen the letter the Humane Society wrote you. I hope you read through that. I read through it several different times. It scares the holy shit out of me. But if we take an aggressive approach on cougar management, we may find that this is not the venue where cougar management is taken, but it's going to be in the hands of a judge. In the hands of a judge is going to take a look at the data. He's probably going to err on the side that we shut down cougar hunting. And then we're not going to have the ability to go out there, and hunters and sportsmen, to be able to take the necessary cougars to affect, you know, successful deer trends. Book list deer trends going up. Let's go to 2025, call it good for there, and we can come back next year, and if we need to stay at that number, we can. But I'll tell you what, your numbers are way down, and it's going to take a lot more to fill them quotas and stuff, and the quality is pathetic out there.
Okay, thank you, Guy. Any other comments from the public? Okay, thank you. Well, we'll start with some discussion here by the rack. How are we feeling?
Well, I guess I'll start out and just say, yeah, it does seem like an extremely high increase, you know, in 1 year to go from 20 to 38, 90%, it does seem like a pretty high number, and I don't know what the right number is, but, you know, I guess I'll just say that and just kind of start the discussion with that. I guess I'd be a little uncomfortable supporting the recommendation of 38 permits based on what I'm hearing here and how I feel. So, any other thoughts?
Yeah, I'll just keep coming. It does seem like last year the proposal was, you know, to raise it higher at higher level, and we chose to go more moderate. And I feel better with going a more moderate number. Also, that does seem a huge increase.
Can I ask Jack a question?
Yeah.
If the deer percentage actually hit 65. And didn't hit that trigger, what would the recommendation be where it's only 1 or 2% from there?
That would bump out of predator management into that cougar management.
It would, and then it'd depend on where you were at with female, your percent female. If your percent female was over 40, then they'd be decreasing. If it's where it's at now, then they could maintain.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe just another question that was brought up about the amount of elk out there versus the amount of deer and what influence that may have. Booklets I'm passionate about, like Mr. Webster. I was on a horse there in the mid-80s and saw lots of deer and didn't see any elk. Just wondering if you feel like there's any influence about increasing the harvest on elk to help the deer herd, if you guys have seen any correlation there. Again, I know that area very well. I spent lots of summers out there on the back of a horse pushing cows. So we saw lots of deer, very few elk. Most of the elk were down in the cedars. So just what your thoughts are on that, Dax.
Yeah, you know, deer versus elk competition, it's another one of those, you know, there's probably something to it, especially in a unit like the Book Cliffs where we do have a really limited amount of summer range. And we have, you know, our elk population is not too objective either. I think Clint was telling me it's about 73% of the objective. It's hard to say for sure if there's direct competition between deer and elk, but it could be a factor. You know, you're right. I mean, that's an area where, you know, 30 years ago there weren't a lot of elk there. We have a lot more elk there now than we did then.
Dax, before you leave, I guess I got a question. Last year, wasn't the proposal to up the quota to 30 in the Book Cliffs?
Was it 28 or 30? I'm trying to remember. It was 30 last year.
It was 30, and as this rack, I think we didn't want to go quite so much. But as Andrew said, we kind of wanted to go moderate and down
just
to...
One thing, too, I guess, just to kind of maybe refresh folks' memory, the year before that, the Book Cliffs and the 9 mile units were combined. It was a combined quota. And so, and the quota was 40, and we harvested 35 lions in the Book Cliffs that year. And then the next year, they split it. They split the Book Cliffs and the 9 mile into two separate units. And, you know, and originally when we had set the 40 quota, based on historic harvest, we figured we'd harvest maybe 10 lions on the 9 mile and thought maybe the other 30 in the Book Cliffs. Ended up being 35 in the Book Cliffs. And then when we split it, you know, our recommendation was 30 in the Book Cliffs, which was reduced to 20. So in this year, we're recommending 38, which is high. It's an aggressive recommendation, but part of that is because we didn't get, you know, any of the increase we asked for the year before.
So actually in 2013, we harvested 35 in there.
Yes.
And did we see any, I guess we kind of talked about the deer. I guess that's probably a dumb question. So then last year we had 20. We harvested 20, so we actually harvested less last year than we did the year before. Okay. Any other questions, comments by the RAC?
So just Dan? To clarify, what's driving this recommendation? Is it being so far from population objective? Is that what's driving this recommendation from the division? Because the numbers that, you know, the 28% females, 30%, you know, greater than or equal to 5 years old. Those aren't. That's not what's driving it.
That's part of it. You know, we try to look at all the different data that we collect when we make a recommendation instead of just, you know, the one factor. We're way below population objective for deer. Yes, that's probably driving, but there's other passengers in the car. You know, there's other factors that we consider when we make that recommendation.
What has been the deer herd or the deer quota as far as the amount of deer that have been taken, as far as what the DWR has given out over the last few years. As far as
buck tags?
Buck tags, yes.
Clint, you have those on it? It's 400 to 500, somewhere in there?
Yeah, last year we gave out 550. This last year, basically the same to the last 540.
So.
Are you guys okay with that? Is that something you guys decide on? Are you comfortable with that number?
Our buck management is based on our buck-to-doe ratios. So, you know, for your bucks really aren't what's driving population numbers in your mule deer. You know, we have mule deer populations with low buck-to-doe ratios that do real well and grow and have high fawn-to-doe ratios. I mean, that's what's driving your population growth in your deer. Our buck numbers, that's going to affect our quality. If we harvest a lot of bucks, we're going to have probably lower quality bucks taken by hunters. If we harvest, you know, a smaller number of bucks, then, you know, hunters are going to harvest bigger bucks. And so our buck-to-doe ratios, we did have a drop that correlated with our population drop in the book cliffs, and the buck-to-doe ratio, like the population numbers, is climbing, but we haven't increased permits. Even last year, our buck-to-doe ratio actually was, you know, towards the upper end of what we're supposed to manage for, 25 to 35 bucks per season in the book cliffs. We didn't recommend an increase just because it's just starting to make that upward trajectory. So, you know, buck quality, you know, it's hard to determine the relationship between deer numbers and lion populations, but I think there's probably more evidence there than there is, you know, directly a correlation between, you know, buck quality and lion numbers. So, so the buck quality is not really part of this recommendation.
I've got a question. Now, this ain't just only the deer we're talking about. We're talking about the bighorn sheep, too, that are in that backseat with those deer.
Yeah, and you know, there's the only bighorn sheep that are really on the non-tribal lands in that area would be that rattlesnake stuff down that kind of the south end of Desolation Canyon. You know, there are a lot of bighorn on the tribal lands. You know, they're in the northern part of that Desolation Corridor, but it's quite a ways from where our hunters are hunting. Really,
our sheep population is way down. So you know, there's something going on there.
Sounds to me like the 38 number isn't as aggressive as I thought it was when I first saw it, but knowing that we killed 35 2 years ago and we haven't seen a whole lot of change other than was able to fill our quota earlier this year than we did the year before. Is that right? Fill in February in 13 and, February. Or 14 and January in 15.
And there's some truth to the fact Bookcliff does have a lot of access. And the timing on quota fill, it's a function of multiple things. You know, snow conditions, if you do get snow or don't get snow, that can make a difference, and access can make a difference. So, you know, you can't say that just when the quota fills, you know, there's maybe some reflection of what availability is, but it's a function of other things as well, too, to be fair.
Randy, man, I don't talk out of place, but we got to keep in mind 2 years ago, that quota went to 35. Last year it went to 20, and you went back and looked at the dates. Where the 20 lions would have been filled the year before, I bet it would have been even earlier. There's less lions. If you're comparing apples and oranges there, just to clarify that.
Okay, any other discussion on the rec? I'll entertain a motion. All right, no motion.
I'll make a motion that we... you know, accept the division's proposal as it's been presented, with the exception on the book lift unit, and raise that from 20 to 27.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we got a motion. I think everybody heard and understood it. We got a second.
Thank you, man.
All right, looks like Tim second. Dad, let's have a discussion about it. How do we feel about that?
Was that half the recommendation? 20 to 30.
That is the
recommendation.
I'm sorry,
was that Missy?
Seven, no. That's half of what they're proposing?
Not quite.
No, it's nine.
It's just
I can
under,
do the math real fast.
Yeah, 9 would be.
It's late in the day. I can't do math. They've been making me do math all week.
That's just under half.
Yeah, so instead of like a 90% increase from 20 to 38, it's somewhere around 35 to 40% increase.
Okay.
agriculture. Any other discussion before we call for a vote on it? Any other? Okay, we'll call for a vote on it. The vote is to accept the recommendation, with exception of the book cliffs, and raise that from 20 to 27 permits, as opposed to the recommended 38. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Unanimous. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. I guess you're up next also. We're going to talk about the fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendation.
You can't get rid of me yet.
I do have one comment on a card on this one. Does anybody else want to fill one out? Please fill one out and provide one.
So the character went.
I need to get looking.
H is my eyebrows.
Maybe you should put this as an adoption thing. All righty. So a little bit of background on bobcat before I jump into it. And this will be brief. We have a bobcat management plan that has some variables in it that tell us how many tags or permits that we can offer for bobcats and how many a person can buy. For the past several years, from 2010 to for the past 3 years until this last year, there was a cap on the number of bobcat tags that could be sold, and that was right about 4,000. In 2014-15, the bobcat populations, the variables came back within target, and so the cap on the number of bobcats that were sold was lifted. So this past year, people were able to purchase 6 bobcat tags per person, and an unlimited number could be sold. We did sell 13,475 bobcat tags. Now, when we saw that, there was concern that, oh, we're going to have this huge, huge harvest in bobcats. But it, as you can see, so the yellow line down there, the red line are the number of tags that have been sold since 2004. The yellow line is the number of bobcats that have been harvested. You can see that in conjunction with that high of 11,000 tags in about 2006, there was an increase in harvest to about 2,800 bobcats. This past year, there were 2,919 bobcats that were harvested. So there was a high number, but we didn't exceed anything. I mean, we're in line with where we've seen previous years. And that kind of tells us that even though you sell a whole lot, you kind of have to be experienced and know what you're doing in order to trap bobcats. So it's not all bad. We had total trap harvest this past year was 2,776, total incidental kill 78, total non-trap harvest 143. Typically we average about 941 trappers that go after bobcats, and we have about 388 hunters. This past year, with the increase, the unlimited cap, we saw an increase to 1,105 trappers and 305 hunters for a total of 1,410 people that pursued bobcat. So our bobcat management plan, it is set to expire this next year, so we'll be working on that plan over this next year, and I'll be bringing that to you this time next year. But there are 4 variables that we look at in order to try and determine where we set bobcat permit numbers. We look at the percent young in the harvest, and there's a target range of 42 to 56%. We look at the percent adult survival. That's based on our tooth ages and some modeling information. We look at that to be 65 to 72%. We look at the percent females in the harvest, and we don't want that to be greater than 45%. We like it to be between 41 to 45. And then the only non-biological metric variable up here is set days per bobcat. And the target range that was set for that is 177 to 220 days per bobcat. I'm not sure where that number came from, but I'll I'll show you here in just a second. It's a variable that can be skewed if you have a lot of non-experienced people out there. I think they were trying to get at bobcat population. If it's lower, it will take you longer to trap a bobcat. But quite honestly, I think it might also be biased, because if you have less experienced people that don't put traps in the right place, it'll take them longer to trap a bobcat. So it's one of those things that I don't think it's really representative. So you can see that I've got the trend here in harvest for the past several years. Our percent juvenile, or the column with the arrows is what I'm looking at. Our percent juvenile in the harvest was 60%. That's really a good, it's outside the target range, but in a good direction. You do like to see a few more juveniles in your harvest than your adults, just because it does indicate growing population. That coupled with percent survival. Juvenile in the harvest without the with the survival being low would be the opposite. So if your percent survival this past year was 74%, that's above the target range, which is a good metric. Our percent female was right at 45%, and then set days per bobcat was way outside of the target range at 373 days per bobcat. So the plan kind of says that if less than two of the performance targets are outside of the range, then you can return to baseline. And it says net, so they use it to cancel each other out. So the set days per bobcat would cancel out one or the other two. So you only have one performance target that's actually outside of the range, if that makes sense. And the baseline is 6 tags allowed per individual. The season can run from the third Wednesday in November to the second Sunday in February, with no cap on the number of tags that were sold. One of the requests last year when we came around and it was approved by the Wildlife Board was to add an additional week onto the end of the bobcat season. That was approved, and so I took and looked at harvest by week to see if there is an increase in the trend of if the timing of harvest changes whether or not you trap males or females. And as you can see, if you get later into the season, about week 9, the male harvest goes up and female harvest goes down. And that's actually a better thing for bobcat populations. And so I thought I'd share that with you. So our recommendation this year is to allow 6 permits per individual. The season will run from November 18th to February 7th, 2016, with no cap on the number of permits that are sold. Along with that, I have to recommend our fur bearer season dates for this upcoming year. For beaver and mink, we're recommending September 26th to April 6th of 2016. Badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel, we're recommending September 22nd to February 7th. And marten, the same date, September 22nd to February 7th. We have one requested rule change. This has to do with trapping on state waterfowl management areas. This isn't really a recreational opportunity. This is a management action for our agency. And what we've done to try and make it fair for the public in the past is we kind of held a drawing to allow for the opportunity to go trap on the WMAs. There are about 40 people that put in for those every year. The problem that we've run into is the people that are drawn for that opportunity aren't always the best qualified. We've had a couple that were non-residents and came down once or twice, and then we didn't get the action that we needed. Really, we use this to control muskrats, to prevent dike damage, and all of the improvements that they do on the WMAs, to protect nesting waterfowl from predation, raccoons, skunks, foxes, and that type of thing. And so what we're requesting is that we change language in the rule to allow us to collect proposals. So it's basically like a bid process. We'll collect proposals from the public, and we'll select the proposal with the greatest benefit to the division and the sportsman. In order to qualify, they'll be rated on their trapping experience, their familiarity with the WMA, their ability to focus on the area and actually go to the area and do the work that we need done. And that's what I have for you. He was a mean little guy.
Okay, thank you, Leslie. All right, questions by the rack. Missy?
How do you determine the survival?
I got this last night, so I'm prepared tonight. So every bobcat that's harvested, we collect the lower jaw, and we take a tooth out first and then an annulate. And there's a estimator, a population estimator. It's called Chapman Robson. Basically what it does is it uses the age data to kind of build your population and estimate working back on a curve. And so that's what we use. It works better for bobcats than it does for cougar or bear. So that's, we can use it for bobcats, but not so much cougar or bear because we violate assumptions. So.
Okay. Other questions by the rack?
Yeah, I got one. Last year when we approved that, were that the guys that came in as the fur bearers, did that help them with their, because I know we met them in the middle too, and I know the guy wanted to go 2 weeks longer, and we agreed 1 week, because he was saying the toms are bigger and they get a little better price out of the...
Right. And so that's why we took and looked at that data to see actually what, and honestly, for population, if you look at the graph, early on in the season, they're catching male and female equally, and that's really not a good thing for the population. And so as we work on the plan going forward, we're probably going to recommend some season date changes to actually start later and go later, so that we increase male harvest and reduce female harvest.
Yeah, because I know they wanted 2 weeks earlier and 2 weeks later.
Yeah, I think we'll look at something like starting maybe in December. But, I mean, we'll work through a committee to do that. I can't say that's exactly what we'll do. But we'll probably start maybe December and the end of February and do something along those lines to try and protect the females a little more.
Might be a comment more than a question, but we never talk about financial benefit of some of these strategies. And by selling all them tags, you obviously make a lot more money.
Well,
for operation of the DWR.
So last year, we actually came around and requested a fee increase on bobcat tags, and that was approved. But it didn't go into effect when the cap was taken off, and so it was still at $5.
But still, that's $50,000.
Right.
More. And then when we do these harvest objectives, that's got to, I mean, if there's no negative impact on the population, there's got to be an economic benefit to switching.
Yeah, and this year, so after it was approved through the board, it went through the legislature. So this year, tags will be $15 each instead of $5.
Any other questions by the rack? All right. Questions by the public? Comments by the rack? Well, Kent, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kent Fountain, President of the Utah Trapping Association. I'm before you tonight in support of the amendments or the proposals by the division at this time. With one caveat, I would request again the 1 week extension on the season. Part of it is, as the data shows, is helping us to prove a point. Same time, it's helping. Leslie collects more valuable data, in our opinion. It's getting us to where we're harvesting more toms, and that's what we're all after. So, got any questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Kent, appreciate you coming to us tonight. All right, looks like we got a discussion. Let's. Leslie, how would that affect the week extension of the season? How do you think that would affect?
There is one request I have to make if you do that, so I forgot about that. Honestly, I don't think it will affect the population in a negative way. I think it's better to harvest more males than females, since females are the ones putting litters back, animals back into the population. So I don't think it will impact it negatively. The one thing I would request, though, if you do recommend that additional week, we ran into a law enforcement situation last year because the week wasn't added on to these other species, the badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, skunk, weasel, and marten. And so we had people out there trapping for bobcat, and there was incidental take, and these were closed seasons. So if you add the week to bobcat, I'd request that you add a week to those species as well.
Would it negatively affect any of them?
I don't believe so, no.
Thank you. What's the other racks done? Can I ask you that? Have they've suggested any extensions?
Yeah, they've added. Every rack is added a week. I guess the only thing I'd say is I'd probably recommend the week. I just can't by plan. That's why I'm not.
Okay, thank you. All right. Any other discussion on this one? If not, I'll entertain a motion on this item.
Motion that we go ahead and accept as presented, with the caveat of extending the season on bobcats and the other fur bearer animals by a week.
Okay. Any discussion on it? We need a second.
I'll take a look.
Tim, we got a second?
Can I just ask you to exclude beaver and mink?
Okay, excluding beaver and mink.
Thanks.
Thank you. Let's talk about it. Any discussion on this? Well, we'll call for a vote. Let's vote on this. It has to do with extending a week for everything but beaver and mink. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It is unanimous.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Motion we take a 5-minute break, if that is possible.
I think that's possible. Let's take 5 minutes and then we'll get into the AAS rule.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Very well done.
That is an excellent idea. We never did that last year, and it's like when 10 meetings over, it's like you just die.
Good time to sit down and get a drink.
All right. Just 5 minutes. A 4 or 5 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Next time, I'm going to push this table out about 2 feet. I like this. I always made sure I sat on the desk.
And then I'm already here.
You'll be talking to
just
then.
That's actually from his books. That's not made up. I had a copy from his books. One of my patients said it was trapping for a
week-long class.
I didn't want it to get stuck in my stuff.
This is the AIS rule. So the directly update, yeah, I'm giving them an actual update on the whole project, and then I'm writing the action item, which is just a anytime you start to have this species in a new location, I get the
Did he show you the picture?
So yeah, that
one that's come after death.
No, last presentation, which I'm going to be asleep for. I don't know how I'm going to make it. Honestly, really, so I need to come over here. It's 8:30 right now. So 9:30 is 8:30 when I start winding down. You know. I usually have to decompress for about 2 hours in the evening after everything is done, and you know, and then just like just chill, just relax, or either watch a movie or an hour of read. So yeah, I'm usually like turning the light off and rolling over, winding down by 8:30. Eric has said, you know, cry or we'll do something like maybe go on to
Missy and I were just discussing a question I had. So what happens on the PDO, like with your oil field pipeline, if you, what would happen if you came to like a dinosaur? Or what would make, is there anything, any fine that would make you reroute your pipeline to avoid a paleo site? You know, like we do with culture. Well, I don't know if you guys do with culture.
We do avoid cultural dynamics. The biggest thing that would push us to move it from paleo is if they could not collect it, it would be costly to collect it.
So maybe you could have a full dinosaur skeleton?
Or, you know, vast amount of bones.
Oh, okay. So like another dinosaur quarry type?
Yeah.
Oh,
well, not even that, or if there's just vast quantities of it and all the documentation. If it's a big project, that won't be that big of an issue. You know, but if it's just like, think of like an irrigation line, like a right of way, where it's like, it has to pay.
I don't know.
You know, if the farmer has to pay $300,000 to get it.
Well, like, this one that I'm working on, I think the easement is about $1,145. So, yeah, if it would cost $3,000 to remove.
You know, it's like if it costs more than the whole project, it's like, wait a minute, you know. You got to think that variable, you know.
Yeah, I would guess down in Main Canyon where there is Safari Outland, it's probably pretty unlikely that there'd be.
I guess it's that guy that was covering back there, although he looks like he's gone now.
Depending on what kind of disturbance they're doing.
Yeah.
You know.
30 inches of cover is a lot.
So yeah, it wouldn't be that aggressive.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's just something I'm not familiar with.
Yeah. And I'm thinking then, and you should have enough alluvial cover. Because, like, they'll send out, what we do is send out a surveyor, you'll take a look at it. And they'll take a look at predictions at the, you know, the formations. Go, oh, yeah, that formation is very heavy, also bearing, usually. So they'll say, either you need a monitor on it, or
put the rest laid up here right after the IS.
What did they do if they find both? That was what I was
thinking.
They
collecting.
That's, you know, I was on an on-site on travel grounds.
That'd be part of it.
Where, as they were walking, because you're walking on the surface, guys, like, here's a bone, here's a bone, here's a bone.
Hanging out, ready to eat.
People were doing that, right? Yeah. Being turtle, and I just
like, we'll do it right afterwards. We'll let you go home.
Yeah, and I mean, there was one area, and it was in a clayish sump, where it was kind of like, wow. And I'm like, I didn't hike down to it, but they were finding jaws, turtle shells.
Wow.
And it's just like, holy cow.
What do they give when they collect it? Who do they give it to? I should know this, but I
you know, they
pay it to museums, universities.
Yeah. So usually like, people who will come collect it will be someone who they have to have a permit to do the collection. And it's usually a university or a museum.
Okay.
Then they just put it in the box and store it.
Because otherwise, it would be, I mean, those would be pretty valuable.
But you see, and I'm trying to think, if it's non-mammalian, you can collect any fossil.
Really?
Yeah. You do not need a permit.
Well, I guess what I think, I know they're valuable. Well, I think they're valuable because I was watching this show called Strange Inheritance about this guy that inherited a ranch in Montana from his father and comes in and he started finding all these fossils. Like, he had this skull that he sold for like $40,000.
See,
that's the thing. If it's or is it non-vertical? I can't remember.
There's something, because I thought you were okay collecting actually mammals.
I can't remember.
We can get through the mammal rest.
But I think it's, you know, like your leaf. That you don't need a fossil. Because there's some down south of Coyote Basin there off.
Because the feed schedule had no recommendation. It was all. Yeah, Roger did a good job. Yeah, he's good. It's just a no-no. It's had it for quite a while. It's rose price, 2 cents, these things. Yeah, I came back off of it. So they're all machines on these boards. Like they got that done. I kind of want a lot of experience here. The goshawk and the widget and also.
There you go,
Ryan. So get started again if we could.
That's good.
I'm afraid to use that gavel.
Yeah. He's pretty good at using that gavel, yeah.
Up next, we've got the AIS rule amendments. And then right after that, we're going to jump down to the Red Fleet Management Plan. As Trina's going to do both those for us, so we'll turn the time to her for the AIS first.
Great. Thank you very much. My name is Trina Hedrick. I'm the Regional Aquatics Manager. Jordan asked me to do his presentation. I guess he travels a lot and for some reason didn't want to come out to Vernal tonight. It's his loss, though. So this is a rule change. There's about three changes that I'm going to go through. First is the definition of decontamination. We're basically presenting an alternate form of decontamination by a COR. So it will allow, it require the COR has to be issued to a business owner. It can't just be any old person off the street. It has to be to a business owner, and they have to have a definite need. So they have many watercraft that they use frequently, and they therefore can't wait the necessary dry time or they have watercraft that's damaged by high temperatures and high pressure. So, for instance, rafting companies on the Colorado, they're a low-risk group, really, and they want to be in compliance, but they often have to reuse their equipment immediately just to keep up with clientele. They can't use the high-pressure and high-temperature treatments that we recommend on the professional decontamination. So what this is going to do is basically allow us to allow these folks with the COR to do a little bit different form of decontamination. So there's other things you can do, like use Quat 128 or some such things, or maybe just say these rafts are only going to go down the Colorado River. We're not going to go to the Colorado and then go to the Green the next time and that kind of thing. So there are things that we can do to try and be a little bit more flexible for these folks who we probably do need to be a little bit more flexible for. And the next change is the boundary of Lake Powell. So when it was first declared infested back in 2003, we had to define the boundaries so that we could tell people, if you have your boat in this area, this defined area within this boundary of Lake Powell, then you have to have a professional decontamination or go through that required dry time. And apparently we used Spanish Bottom, which is within canyon lands, but it seemed logical because that was the point where the motorized boats would turn around. So anything past that, you're going into Cataract Canyon, you're going into Lake Powell, you need to decontaminate. If you just go down to Spanish Bottom, turn around, you're not in Lake Powell. So, but what has happened, apparently, is that Canyonlands National Park, now that we're saying that there's this mandatory decontamination past Spanish Bottom, they are going to have craft a management plan for quagga mussel, even though...
break a lot, here I am, I want to launch. It's actually not going to be illegal for that boater to remove the tag himself if he has gone through the proper dry time, has a professional decontamination, and then just does the self-certification before he launches. So it doesn't limit people's ability to launch if there's nobody at around. But it does, it basically is just preventing people from monkeying with this tool that we have to be able to track boats and know exactly when they last launched and where, if they went to these problem waters. I think that actually covers the proposed changes.
Thank you, Trina. Questions by the rack?
Question. On the change with the kind of business entity, through the COR process, them being authorized to decontaminate, is that just on a volunteer basis, compensation for that business entity, or how's that going to work?
Compensation.
Well, I mean, for a business entity to take on that responsibility of decontamination. It's time, it's money. Is there going to be compensation involved there?
No.
So it's just really in the best interest of everyone, obviously, but in particular that business entity.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Lucerne Valley Marina or Buckport Marina, are those examples of business entities that would take on this?
I wouldn't think that, where you have a marina and maybe you have all these facilities, but those are staying in one place. I think really it's the rafting community.
Right.
So just things like, if you should be cleaning, draining, drying, that kind of thing, and maybe you can't let it go the appropriate dry time for AIS purposes, but you can clean your boat with Quant 128. It's a kind of a professional cleaner that you can just get in any cleaning supply store. That's really not that expensive and really keeps things pretty clean. That's what we use to clean waders for whirling disease and putrid and that kind of thing. So it's a pretty good cleaner. You can also, like I said, have these boats that do Cataract Canyon and anything on the Colorado, and then there's this set of boats that goes to the Green River and only the Green River, and I don't know what the conversation that Jordan has had with these companies, but I would think it's along those lines. So
geared towards the rubber rafts, then I guess it sounds like
things that can't handle that professional decontamination for either pressure or heat purposes.
And we've talked about that, Dan, as far as letting other organizations be authorized to do decontaminations, like what Wyoming does, for example. But we're not there yet. We're not ready to go that route.
Okay.
Any other questions by the rec? We'll ask the leftover public.
All right. Thanks, guys.
I don't see any questions there.
Any comments? Any discussion?
So yeah, maybe just can you kind of brief us with what's going on down at Lake Powell? What's going on with I guess trying to control? Because it's in Lake Powell. So what's going on with the latest with as far as like trying to keep it at Lake Powell with the relationship with the Division of Wildlife and National Park Service?
Sure. Can you speak on that?
Yeah.
Okay. So with Lake Powell this year, we got additional 30 technicians down there covering both Wahweap and Bullfrog, and two additional biologists to take care of all the administrative stuff over the new technicians. So we're checking everybody coming off of those areas and making sure that they are draining and drying their boat. At that point, we're putting on that orange seal, designating when they were last there and what was done. Not too many decontaminations are being done. We do a few in cooperation with the National Park using their decontamination units, but just due to the sheer quantity of boats coming out that lake, we're limited on how many decontaminations we can do. So we do decontaminate them once they get to other parts within the state, because they have that seal on there. So that's the route we're going with that.
Okay, thanks.
Any other discussion? Comments? Well, we'll entertain a motion for this item.
I make a motion that we approve this as presented.
Doug makes a motion to approve it as presented. Any second?
I'll second.
David's got the second. Any other discussion? We'll call for a vote. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Trina. Now we're going to do the Red Fleet Management Plan.
Yes. Okay. A few months back, I came and presented on the Rapid Response Plan and Control Plan for AIS, and I promised an update, but I also have an action item here for you, so when the action item comes up, I'll be very clear. So as you guys are all hopefully aware, we have been working on a Red Fleet Rote Known Treatment Plan for this October, and I just wanted to go through some of the things that we've been doing, some of the planning, and where, I guess, kind of our thought process of why we decided that we really needed to do this. So this presentation is going to kind of take through the problem of illegal introduction and escapement of walleye, the solutions we considered, our planning effort, and how we address some of the concerns that were brought up during the scoping of the environmental assessment, and then the species list, because that's kind of exciting to us, and then our project timeline. So the Upper Colorado River Endangered Fish Recovery Program, as most of you know, they are an entity of multiple federal, state agencies, water users, environmental users or environmental groups, just a lot of groups that get together and talk about how to protect the endangered fish and then obviously do the implementation, but while water development proceeds. So it's kind of important to this part of the world. Things were going really well until the increase of walleye in the Green River, which started in about 2011. And since then, and it was a significant increase, it was substantial. I shouldn't use the term significant, that implies a statistical test, but it was a substantial increase, very visible. And the correlation, not causation, but the correlated decline in Colorado pike minnow was kind of alarming as well. So we have this increase in this non-native predator, and then we have this decrease in the native predator, and it's extremely concerning. We were actually thinking that the timeline for downlisting and delisting the pike minnow could be, you know, 2023, I think it was. So now that's kind of suspect. So it seems like that the walleye is probably the big factor that's contributing to that, considering the timing and that substantial increase in numbers. So where are the sources? Where are these fish coming from? Red Fleet Starvation in Lake Powell. We have signatures. So the otoliths are the ear bones in a fish, and we have isotopic signatures from the otoliths and fish taken from the Green River that are equivalent to the isotopic signature of these ear bones from fish taken from Red Fleet. So basically, the upshot is that you can tell where a fish has been by looking at minerals that accrete in its ear bones. And other bones too, but the otoliths are really, like, it's rock solid. So the other fish came from starvation and or Lake Powell. They couldn't quite distinguish that signature. So the recovery program definitely had evidence that these walleye that are hurting the Colorado pike minnow are coming from definitely Red Fleet Reservoir and most likely starvation, although, like I said, they couldn't differentiate between Lake Powell and starvation. All right, so what are the solutions? What can we do? We can screen reservoirs. And this picture is a screen that's down below the spillway stilling basin below starvation. This is a temporary screen that we've been using for the last 2 years until we can get a more permanent structure in place. So that will prevent escapement from the spillway stilling basin, which we know is happening because of a study we did in 2005. We can use sterile sport fish. So sterile walleye is the first sterile fish that we're really working on and really trying to hone in the hatchery. So a fish is sterilized either by pressure treatment or heat shock treatment. And I think walleye is going to be a pressure treatment. And they're working on that now, have in the last couple of years, and trying to perfect that within the state hatcheries. There's other possible sterile sport fish that could come on in future years, like the smallmouth bass, which is also a problem for Green River fish. We can use low or no threat sport fish. Largemouth bass do really well in reservoirs. They don't do well in rivers. So that's on the, that and a lot of other species are on what's considered the compatible list. We can also do rodent treatment, chemical removal, and that is the only way to get 100% eradication of all of your fish. So given the issue, given all of that, we know Red Fleet is a Bureau of Reclamation dam, so owned by the federal government, and it's a secondary drinking water source. But just because it's secondary doesn't mean that it's not used every year. It is used every year between April and September 30th, and it's also a state park, and visitation is highly variable and seems to fluctuate substantially with water levels and with just fishing and how well the fishing is. And so you don't really want to impact your state park because you know that they've been having problems in the last few years with low water levels. So that kind of all of that triggered the need for an environmental assessment to take a look at the project and really like lay it all out on the table and then have a group analyze the impacts. Fishery then, rainbow trout fishery. We also had largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, bluegill, and walleye illegal introduction. So what do we replace it with? It's kind of funny, I should emphasize, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, bluegill, walleye, all illegal introductions. The only fish we, the division, have ever stocked into Red Fleet Reservoir was the rainbow trout. So anyway, what to replace these species with? There was a lot of concern in the scoping about, what if walleye just end up back in there? How do you know it's going to work? Things like that. The public, the angling public, is very concerned. So we thought it would be best to get angler input on species and then a vision and goals for the reservoir. And so that was a process we went through. We developed a management plan, and we had about 12 individuals representing different angler interests, including largemouth bass, walleye, one guy for bluegill, and then a couple for the trout. So in addition to that, we've got this drinking water source. So how are we going to deal with that? Nobody wants to drink Rona, and I certainly don't. So we'll do the treatment in October. We won't do it before September 30th. We'll also ensure that we call the Central Utah Water Conservancy District and the treatment plant and make sure that water withdrawals are completely done for the year before we move forward. October visitation levels for the state park are pretty low. So we'll go ahead and with October. We can't really push it back into November, which would be even lower visitation because rotenone breaks down more quickly with sunlight, warmer temperatures. And if you go too late, you could be detoxing your outflow for basically until spring. So we don't want to push it back too far. We also will restock as soon as we possibly can. We have, I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's awesome. We have 90 sterile walleye that are ready to go back in as soon as the reservoir has been detoxed and the rotenone has degraded. We've got rainbow trout. They didn't make the list, as I think I'm going to get to here. Rainbow trout did not make the list for perpetuity, but we do have some rainbow trout we can put back in there. And we're also going to stock, with approval, Colorado River cutthroat trout. So anyway, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So what species do we replace those that we are going to eradicate? Colorado River cutthroat trout in the Brush Creek is a secondary catch in the reservoir, but initially, because the reservoir will be completely reset, we are going to stock 8,000 into the reservoir and 2,000 into Brush Creek. We do have approval for that. Sterile walleye, we have 90 to go in this year, and the quota is going to stay kind of low until we can get our prey base up, but we'll do probably a couple hundred every year for the next 3 years. In 2016, we can start stocking the fingerling sterile walleye, though, because they're going to be eating smaller items. They're going to be eating zooplankton, and they're not going to be switching to fish too quickly. Yellow perch, black crappie, mountain whitefish, we're going to start stocking those hopefully this winter after the treatment in 2016 and every year until they're established. Each of these will eventually reproduce on their own. That would be the goal. If they don't, then we will go back to the drawing board and try and find a replacement prey item. Fingerling wipers and tiger trout will start in 2016. Again, we're going to stock as fingerlings, try and get that prey base going before we get bigger fish in there. We also plan to stock fathead minnow to help establish predators just for a couple of years. Typically, fathead minnows, you stock them in and everybody gobbles them up and they don't last very long. So, but we can get them pretty cheaply, so we think it will help get the fishery going. Largemouth bass, that was a question mark because there's so many species going in, and we got black crappie, which could compete with largemouth, and everyone's pretty excited about crappie. The largemouth is a question mark for now. We may or may not put it back in. We'll just have to evaluate our success and go from there. So the action item is the new native species on the left there, the Colorado River cutthroat trout. It's a state-sensitive species that we request the ability to introduce into Brush Creek and the Inflota Ridfleet Reservoir for sport fish purposes. Mountain whitefish, I just, thought I'd throw that in. It's not a state-sensitive species. It's already a game fish, but it's kind of cool that we're going to try and hype it as a sport fishery and also utilize it as a prey base. So the timeline for the project, the EA already went through RDCC and the draft comment period, so we're finalizing that. I've seen the draft FONSI, which I don't know what it stands for, I just know it's the signatory sheet. It's basically everybody signs off on it and says we're good to go. So I've seen the draft, and BR has basically said that there were no substantial issues that were going to be problematic to the human environment, to the wildlife, any of that. Thought we mitigated things pretty well. We've gotten our stocking requests approved, and we are moving forward on, like I said, the hatchery folks developing the sterile fisheries. We're going to be preparing equipment over the next 2 months. We still don't have everything purchased. We were waiting for the fiscal year 15 budget to finalize. So once I get the word on being able to spend the money, which the original enhancement was approved, and then the end of year volume estimate for Red Fleet actually increased from June to July. I don't know when that's ever happened before, but it increased substantially. So we need a little bit more money, so we're still waiting. But as soon as that approval happens, we'll start ordering and we can still get stuff in 2 months. Delivery of materials to site the week before and final prep, October 12th. Treatment date will be October 13th, and cleanup and disposal. Of fish, clean up mainly for all the equipment, but we did say that we would clean up dead fish just because it can be an eyesore. October 13th and 14th. Neutralization, we're planning for 3 weeks, hoping for 2 weeks neutralization, but of course it's all going to be dependent upon sunlight and temperatures and mainly those two things. And restocking beginning November 2015 this year. We're going to go in and take some zooplankton samples a couple weeks after, and if we see zooplankton, then we can start that restocking. And that was it.
Okay, thank you, Trina. Appreciate that. I guess I got a question on. I just happened to be at the starvation when they were treating, or I'm sorry, strawberry when they were treating it many years ago, and there was a lot of dead fish. I mean, they were stacked.
It's amazing.
4 or 5 feet on the thing. How are you going to clean those up?
So Red Fleet's only 520 service acres at full pool. Strawberry's like 1 million service acres. So it's going to be a lot fewer fish, but I've already told folks that we can't clean up all of the fish. We're going to spend the next day picking up fish. We will, and take those to the landfill, but there is no possible way. It's amazing. I kind of feel like everyone should see a rotenone treatment when you're worried about fish populations, because for every like one you see, you know, in hand, there's tons under the surface. I mean, obviously it varies depending on location, but there are so many more fish than what you see. You know, you go to, and you don't get a bite the whole day. Oh, there's no fish in here. No, there's tons of fish in there, and it's amazing. They're very plentiful. So, point taken. But hopefully the water level, usually what happens, you do it at the end of the season, and then the water level comes up over the winter and spring and covers up all those dead fish. But who knows what's going to happen now? I can't even tell you what to expect in a water year. But anyway, point being, no, we will not clean up all of the fish. And I've already told
them those couple of days.
We're going to just focus on easily accessible areas like around the campground and that kind of thing. Probably over by the dam and some of the other access points. We usually do pick up a few because we like to go around and see what comes up. You want to see the big fish, especially, you know, see what's in there and take some measurements. And I don't know, even like numbers of little fish is interesting too. So sometimes it's surprising. I mean, when we tipped over Cottonwood, we had 1 million little channel catfish that were like that big, and we had a 23-pound catfish. It was awesome. He's going to be on our wall pretty soon. Anyway, just so people can see, you know, we can grow some big fish. So, anyway.
Thank you. All right, questions by the rec. Missy and then Dan?
You can close the reservoir while you're doing.
We were asked to allow the park to keep the park open, the campground open, but the water is closed. We will have signs up and law enforcement will be out keeping people away from the water. So the EPA requires no fishing, swimming, this can't be fit within 50 feet of the water or something like that. So that's what we're gonna really push, keeping people away from the water's edge at all of the access points. But we're not going to close down the campground. And that way, you know, there's nothing wrong with people coming and watching as long as they stay away from the rotenone, stay away from the water's edge.
Yeah, whereabouts did you plan to stock the Colorado River cutthroat trout? Above the highway? Below the highway?
Oh, they'll probably go in based on what's easiest for the hatchery truck, honestly. So we're thinking taking that little two-track in from the highway, but I don't know at this point if the hatchery truck's going to make it.
Just like immediately above the reservoir, not,
right.
But not higher.
Yeah, along. No, just so they're accessible. Yeah. There's actually quite a few folks that fish that reach there below Simplot. And I don't think that Simplot allows access through there. So. Right there above the reservoir. Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
You said there was an action item.
Yeah, the stocking of the Colorado River cutthroat trout. That's the action item. So the quota is 2,000 fingerlings per year into Brush Creek. So yeah, any new sensitive species stocking has to go through the rack, has to be approved. So I was told.
Other questions? Any public questions? So we'll go to comments.
I've got a comment.
Okay.
You're wondering what FONSI stood for, F-O.
Oh.
Finding of no significant impact.
Yes, that does sound right. Okay. I knew it, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what it is. Finding of no significant impact.
Great, thank you. Let's see if I can remember it.
Any other discussion before we entertain a vote? Well, then I'll entertain a motion for this one.
Second.
Motion.
I do a motion.
I haven't been trained in nothing yet.
I'll make the motion that we accept the action item of stocking the Colorado River cutthroat trout into Brush Creek.
As the division recommends.
And I wonder if it should be also into Red Fleet this first time.
And into Red Fleet as proposed by the division.
Thank you. Second. Missy seconds. Any other discussion before we vote? All right, let's all those in favor. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, unanimous.
Great, thank you guys.
Thank you, Jenna. We'll let you go home now.
How's Mike? You know Mike Murray? He was
Oh.
I thought he was in the presentation.
Oh.
Okay. And we're going to go to the youth fishing exemption rule amendments.
It's funny because when we started off the year and the operator, dam operators, thinking that if before all that rain came, 4,000 acre feet was going to be the end of your volume, and it was going to be dirt cheap to do the project, and now it's open
up.
Yep.
I didn't think it was going to be 100,000. You eliminate the walleye you put in there.
It has ended up being a lot of money. Yes.
All the time studying
you
too.
All right.
Thank you.
My name is Mitch Lane. I'm with the law enforcement section out of Salt Lake. I have three what I think will be fairly innocuous and pretty straightforward proposals. The first one is deals with an amendment to R657-45, which is the rule that allows for fishing license exemptions for school groups and other youth groups. This was actually allowed by code several years ago, and we've actually been using this process. There's a little bit of a typo here that in the code section. It's actually 2319 and 14.5, not 4.5. But nonetheless, this has been in place by code for, I believe, about 7 years. But part of that code, we've been a little bit remiss in following in that we have not gone through this rack and board process to adopt the documentation that that code requires. So this is kind of just a housekeeping thing. And this proposal will satisfy the rest of that code. Currently, for a group to take advantage of this license exemption, they basically go to our website where there's a PDF they can access, they print it out, they fill it out, and they basically keep it on their person in case they are checked in the field by one of our officers. That information to date has not been stored or tracked or documented at all. The new process that we're proposing is again going to be done online. However, it'll be a fillable form in which that information that is obtained on the form will be able to be stored and tracked and used by the division for various purposes. The big one being we'll actually be able to tell and know how many groups are using this process and how many youth are being allowed to experience fishing without the need to obtain a license. The information that they have to provide, it's pretty basic. It's the name of the school or the youth group that they're representing, date and location of the activity, number of the youth involved, and this really applies to youth under 16 and really from 12 to 15, because under 12 they don't need a license anyway. And that part of this code section was actually changed either this year or last year. That minimum age was raised from 14 to 16. I believe it was this last legislative session. And then the name and contact information, pretty basic stuff, information you'd expect on kind of a process or a form like this. Some of the requirements for the group leader, which is the person that's going to be accompanying the youth group on their fishing trip or fishing outing, just some basic requirements. They got to be 18 years or older. They must possess either a fishing or a combination license. They are also supposed to provide instruction to these kids on laws and regulations, and obviously, hopefully, on fishing techniques and methods and things like that. And they're supposed to have approval from this group that they represent. So, in summary, this is an ongoing program. It's already being used. We're making some minor modifications to come in line with the actual code section. The benefits, I think, are obvious and have been being, realized already, in that volunteers are taking kids out, providing them with these fishing experiences, and hopefully introducing them to the sport of fishing, so that they would continue to pursue that. That's it on that one. If anyone has any questions, I would be willing to entertain those.
Thank you, Mitch. Mm-hmm. Seems like a great opportunity for a lot of you that don't get a picture and are used to that. So. All right, got a question by the rec.
I have one. Is it automatic approved, or does it have to be approved by somebody at the division and then when they...
Yes. That application, that online application that they submit, then be reviewed, and the COR actually is what they would be operating under would have to be approved.
How long of a timeline for approval on that? They submit it Friday or Wednesday, and they're hoping to go fishing on Friday night, Saturday. Would it be approved in that short of time, or do they need to do further ahead planning?
I haven't heard, and that's something that may kind of depend on timing and numbers of applications, but obviously I think based on kind of the logic behind this, it's going to be done pretty expeditiously. I mean, it's something we would put a priority on and make sure it happens pretty quick, especially if it's one that happens to be submitted on fairly short notice. We'll do what we can to turn those around quickly.
Cool. We just have youth group playing the boards. What about reciprocals? Does everybody rush? Same age group that you're talking about, but we all look at reciprocals. And Wyoming has this adopted, and whether that would
I don't.
Be
in possible. General, in general, all the other fishing regulations are going to, be the same, and they will be expected to follow those. Now, how that applies to this, if they're not required to have a license because they're covered under this COR, may be different, maybe like at Flaming Gorge versus Bear Lake, where we have different agreements with those different states. Something we may need to kind of look into and be prepared to address, certainly.
Yeah, we were all all scrambling to get reciprocal stamps at the Flaming Moose Resort at like 9:50 at night, so we could go the next morning. So
yeah.
Then with clarification on that, that would be helpful whether that purchase was necessary or not.
Dan, would I be putting you on the spot if I ask you a question?
Yeah, you put me on the spot, and I don't know if I know the answer.
Well, I'm just wondering, like now, for a youth that's not required to have a license, how does that reciprocal agreement work?
If they're not required to have a license here, it's not required there. But this, if they're of age, that Wyoming would require the license.
Yeah.
I don't know if they would. I'm assuming as long as you have a reciprocal stamp, it won't be an issue. I think your question is, do they need the reciprocal stamp?
Right, right.
And that would have to probably be addressed in our agreement with Wyoming, which I doubt it has.
I will certainly make a note, because that's a very good question. It is, and this question has come up at previous RAC meetings. Although it's not maybe specifically spelled out or prohibited or expressly prohibited, this is designed to be for specific day or days. And if you kind of read through the language, it implies that. So it doesn't expressly prohibit it, but it, you know, I think it implies it pretty clearly.
The other question I had is, what are the requirements for a group to qualify for this
exemption? The schools and the definition, I believe, is in your RAC packet. Grades 1 through 9, basically, would meet the definition of a school or a youth group from a school. The other youth groups are defined as examples like Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and then any other 501c3, the non-tax exempt or whatever qualifications. Yeah, that endorse or sponsor activities promoting the outdoors and outdoor recreational activities. The definition is in the rule, and it is spelled out pretty clearly.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, comments? Well, we'll entertain a motion. Anybody would like to make that motion?
I motion we accept the proposal for the Youth Fishing Exemption Rule Amendment as presented.
Do I have a second?
I will second it.
Andrew seconds that? Any discussion before we vote? Well, we'll put that to vote. All those in favor of that recommendation? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Unanimous. Thank you, Mitch. We'll jump on to the next topic. Self-defense against animals rule.
Okay. So this one is a proposal to amend self-defense against wild animals. Like the other proposal and the next one too, this one's really to kind of bring it in line with other Utah code. And in this case, what we're trying to do is bring self-defense against a wild animal closer in line with the other general self-defense laws in the state. And we'll go into kind of some of the specifics. The big one really being that in general self-defense of a person laws in the state, an individual does not have a duty to retreat from a threat. The current wildlife self-defense rule imposes that duty on someone, that they have to retreat. Again, I think in creating and in modifying this self-defense against a wild animal, they've looked at and used a lot of similar verbiage and language in the self-defense against a human statute. So they use the terms that are used in that code as well, you know, reasonable and necessary and use of force, and they all kind of apply. In this case, you know, self-defense is justified when it's deemed reasonable and necessary, and part of that is when a threat is imminent. In the wildlife, the self-defense against the wildlife rules, there's some factors that determine when it's reasonable and necessary. And again, one of those factors was, or currently is listed as, the ability to safely retreat from the threat. We received some comments that the public really shouldn't necessarily have to retreat from a threat of a wild animal, but if they could safely avoid the danger rather than retreating, that would basically result in the same thing as retreating. If they could avoid that threat, then without effectively retreating. So that's what the changes suggested to read is the ability to safely avoid the danger, not necessarily turn and retreat. Might mean going around, you know, giving a wide berth to a moose that's in a trail or something. So that's kind of an example, I think, that would explain that. The Second Amendment, and I think it should really go without saying, we've chosen to clarify and specify life and safety of a human is obviously more important than that of any wild animal. So this amendment would clearly state that. The last amendment to this rule deals with self-defense against a wild animal in what I'm going to call a habitable structure, a home, a tent, a camper, a trailer, or some other type of structure, you know, where someone would be temporarily living or staying. And this all deals with the presumption of innocence. If a person does actually kill or injure a wild animal and claim self-defense, they're presumed innocent. And under certain conditions, and in this case, the condition is that this wild animal has either entered, is attempting to enter, or already occupies one of those structures, and that wild animal is actually a wild animal that's capable of causing death or injury. In other words, not a mouse or a squirrel or something to that, you know, that nature. It's going to have to be an animal that's capable of causing.
I haven't seen my wife around a mouse.
This is an endangered.
So again, it kind of just cleans up and changes some of the existing language in this rule. In summary, the requirement to actually retreat is going to be somewhat, I think, just not minimized, but, you know, reduced to the level of just avoiding that danger rather than full-on retreating. Again, bringing to light the fact that the life and safety of humans is more important than the life and safety of any wild animal out there. And again, the presumption of innocence when someone uses self-defense against an animal that's entering, that has entered or is entering or is already occupying one of those structures. And that animal can cause serious death or bodily injury if if it is in one of those structures. This one probably has a lot more of the, again, because it's trying to replicate self-defense from a human statutes, kind of has more of that legal jargon in the wording of this rule. So, but I think it's fairly well spelled out in there what these amendments are. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mitch. Questions, Brother Rick? I guess I got a question. I suspect the other four recs approved this as written. Is that right?
You know what? I don't know. I'm filling in for my counterpart, Captain Olson, who has attended all four of the other RAC meetings, and I don't know what the results from those have been.
Any questions, comments? Well, we'll entertain a motion.
I have a motion that we accept the rule amendment as proposed by the division.
Thank you, David. Any second?
Second that.
Yes, you second that. Any discussion before we vote? All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's unanimous. Well, we've got one more. Mitch, possession of firearms rule amendment. Order filed up.
Okay, if I can get, I seem to be stuck on this one.
You want that out of your way there.
Okay. Okay, this one actually deals with proposed amendments to two different rules, both the upland game rule and the waterfowl rule, but only as it pertains to use of firearms on division-owned waterfowl management areas. As has been the case with several of our rules over the years, we've tried to bring our firearms laws closer in line with, again, state code that pertains to firearms laws. I think it goes without saying, DWR fully recognizes and supports the Second Amendment and the right for people to bear and possess arms and obviously use them in whatever way they choose. However, having said that, we do have a need to regulate the use of firearms, either for management reasons, safety reasons, or other reasons, on some of the properties that we own. So we have to kind of balance that, our management responsibility versus, again, our obligation to uphold the Constitution and other laws of the state. So up until now, we have restricted or somehow regulated the mere possession of firearms on some of our waterfowl and wildlife management areas. What we're going to propose here is that we're going to back off a little bit, be a little more liberal or conservative, I should say, and we're going to regulate now the possession, the discharge rather than the possession of those firearms. Again, so that we can maintain our management objectives, we can maintain public safety and things like that. So we've in the past prohibited the possession of any firearm unless it was a weapon that was allowed during a certain season for a certain species with certain ammunition. So we're just going to now say, you know, we're not going to restrict the possession of any firearms, but we will restrict the discharge under certain conditions so we can meet our management objectives. So what we'll do is we'll will restrict or regulate the discharge of those weapons during open seasons for lawful hunting purposes, which won't restrict in any way anybody's right to possess any firearms just when they can discharge certain firearms. And so they'll be allowed to discharge those firearms for hunting purposes during seasons, also as authorized by any type of a permit or COR, you know, maybe for management purposes or other administrative purposes. And then I think it goes without saying for lawful self-defense purposes. We certainly wouldn't want to restrict or prohibit the use of firearms for that. So the proposed changes would apply to specific WMAs listed in both the upland game and waterfowl proclamations, and would restrict the discharge versus the possession of certain firearms during certain hunting seasons for lawful hunting purposes mainly, but then would also allow for other uses outside of hunting, whether it be, we talked earlier in another presentation about trapping activities that go on some of these WMAs outside of the lawful hunting season. Well, this would allow for the use of firearms for those types of purposes as well. And then again, you know, I think kind of a no-brainer for lawful self-defense. And in this case, you know, actually could be in defense of one from a wild animal or from another person. I mean, it's just going to be for lawful self-defense purposes in general.
Okay, thank you, Mitch. I guess I got one question. In our region, it looks like we're talking about Browns Park and Stewart Lake. Is there any other areas in our region we're talking about that we might know of?
The one
there is about. Someone from the region might know better than I.
Little
Mondes Creek.
Kevin Conway. Isn't very that. I'm looking at them, and it says Big Mill Bottoms, Blue Lake, Brown Park, Clear Lake, Desert Lake.
And remember, there's two different lists, again, depending on whether you're looking at the upland game rule for kind of upland areas, or the waterfowl rule for waterfowl management areas.
Browns Park and Stewart Lake are the only two waterfowl management areas.
And some are kind of neither, you know, like they're not specifically upland game or waterfowl. They might just be a wildlife management area that, you know, doesn't fall specifically into one of those two categories. The intent was to stick to the ones that are primarily either waterfowl management areas, and that's the predominant activity that goes on there, or upland game areas where, you know, upland hunting activity is the predominant activity that goes on. We didn't want to restrict, you know, or further restrict anything on any of the other areas that aren't listed here. On areas that aren't listed here, you know, firearms can be possessed and used pretty much, I guess, without any regulation, barring any of our other division rules or regulations that govern specific areas, like no target shooting in a parking area, or no shooting within 600 feet of a parking area, or something like that.
Thank you. Other questions, by the way? Comments? Concerned? Everybody tired?
Yeah.
Go home?
Yeah, this does make sense, kind of given the change in the gun law, you know, the ability to carry weapons in vehicles.
Yeah, and like I said, we've had to do this several times throughout the years to kind of just, to get in line with what's going on with firearms and firearm possession.
Yeah.
All right, we'll entertain a motion on this one.
I would think a motion that we accept this proposal as presented.
Okay, Andrew makes that motion.
I'll second it.
David's second. Any discussion before we vote? Well, we'll vote. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Unanimous.
Thank you all.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate you staying for us. All right, we're down to the last action item, the fee schedule.
I think there's nothing there.
There you go.
There you go. We can read that for you. The division has no proposed fee changes for 2016.
I'll accept that.
So, we have a whole discussion.
Questions?
Do you have any questions, concerns, or reasons?
Yeah, I think a motion that we don't accept that. Very good. Almost double these fees.
Well, I'm okay. No, because I did have a question. I'm just kind of curious. Because I was looking at the rates for oil and gas companies. You know, I'm just like, man, those seem to be mighty minimal fees. And I'm sure you guys, the division's got a reason why. You know, easement for oil and gas pipelines per unit is it $250 per foot or?
Per rod.
Per rod? I'm just looking at that and I'm going, man, that seems an awful amount of very little for how much disturbance they cause.
It's set by the legislature at Lee Woods alone.
Okay.
But I think it's probably in line with the civil charges.
Okay. That's right, man. It's like 16 feet.
I think we'd have a lot more developed in the states, just in case.
That was just my only question.
Okay.
Any other questions? Comments? That will entertain a motion. Thank you, Brad. Any second on that?
I'll second it.
David seconded it. Any discussion before we vote? All right, we've got a motion and a second. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's unanimous. Thank you.
I motion we adjourn.
No second on that? I'll second that one.
All in favor?
All in favor, all right.